poet and novelist Jesse Ball, good old number 46 former Bear Doug Plank, and live music in Studio 435 from Chicago's Varsity. And now here's your host, a man who is already beach volleyballed out, Justin Kaufman.
So much sand.
So many butts.
There was one point where I was watching the beach volleyball, and again, just amazing. The tall one, she's just amazing. I forgot her name, but the Pete knows it, I'm sure. What is it?
Are you talking about Carrie?
Yeah, Carrie.
Carrie Walsh Jennings.
There was a point when even my son, 9 years old, was like, "Dad, that's a lot of butts." And I was like, "You're right." And there was something that someone brought up, too. And, you know, I don't usually care about this stuff, but the guys don't play beach volleyball in Speedos. They play them in more like swim trunk affair. So why are we getting more of a European cut swimsuit for not just the Americans, but for every woman who does beach volleyball? Why? I mean, I wonder. I'm not, again, I watched. But at the same time, I feel like it's a little like it's like the IOC or Olympics or beach volleyball has not caught up to the fact that we'll watch without butts. Like, if you put women in shorts, we wouldn't be like, nah, let's see what's going on with rowing. I guess we'll go long distance cycling. Right now, I'm watching the Olympics, and there are two divers who are taking showers. Just get a little crazy. Like, that's all it was. I just have the TV on here in the studio, and you know, Olympics are on, and the shot was two divers taking showers. That's it. I don't know what they were talking about. They probably had a great dive, but all the shot was two divers taking showers, which is really the sum up. Tonight, last week, you came up with a great idea, Pete, and the idea was to fan jam the Olympics, which I'm very excited about. This, of course, we did this last year with the Cubs, where we fan jammed the Cubs game. We can't watch the games because we're on the air, so we thought it would be great to actually fan jam, have fans, real fans, watch it for us. Tell us what's real, what was funny, what was a screw-up on the broadcast, how many divers were taking showers. Molly Green's going to join us later and fan jam the Olympics, because I have a little FOMO going on with the Olympics. I got into it this weekend. I was very excited about it. At the same time, you know what? I don't need to watch 6 hours of it. You know what I mean?
I was saying this morning that I was like, how come we watch so much Olympics this weekend, yet I still have really no idea what's happening?
They're not very good at telling you when it's a semifinal and when it's a final, and not like I would think they would do much more play off the gold medal. Like maybe graphics with a gold medal coming right at you at, you know, or maybe like when the swimmer's in your first, second, third place and the graphics are on the, here it comes Michael Phelps, that you put a little gold medal on his head. So you're like, yes. Oh, he's in the gold medal. And then you know it's a gold medal match. And anything else is just a heat. And then, of course, you know, make sure you get a shot of them taking a shower. It's a download here on WGN Radio, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. What a great show we have lined up tonight. Jesse Ball is here, a great novelist and writer, poet. He's put out 14 works. Just said his book was just came out. Got a great write-up in Atlantic over the weekend. And we're going to talk with Jesse. He actually is from New York, but he's living here because he's a professor at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Talk to him about being a writer here in town. I'm very excited to talk with him. His work is unbelievable. I want to talk to him because they always say he's one of the the leading experimental writers working today. And I was like, what does that mean? What's an experimental writer? So we'll talk to him about that coming up at the big table, 8 o'clock tonight. Also, Hidden Hemingway. We all know that Hemingway was born here in Oak Park, Illinois. We're going to talk to Rob Elder, who put together a nice book diving into the archives of Hemingway. The archives, of course, in Oak Park, Illinois. So we'll talk with Rob about his book, which is really, really nice. So we'll talk with that coming up at 9 o'clock. Also tonight, Doug Plank joins us. I don't know if you read Rob Feeder, but it was announced today that Doug Plank's joining WGN Radio to give Bears analysis and reaction Mondays here on the download. How great is that? It's not every day you get an announcement in Feeder that you know, a former Bear is going to be joining your show on the regular.
Love seeing that.
Right? So really great. I'm so excited to have Doug Plank. We've had Doug on. I enjoy talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to be doing a lot of games throughout the year where he's actually doing broadcast games for radio. And he'll catch up with us the day after and just sort of give us analysis reaction. That's pretty great. Not many shows can say that.
Love it.
The guy whose number, his play inspired the 46D here in Chicago. We'll be breaking down games right after. How great is that? Exciting. So much more on the show tonight. Adam Holger will give us a Bears camp report, of course. And Touche. Excited. I keep saying excited. I've said excited like 35 times in the first. Might have something to do with the corned beef and cabbage I just had for my dinner. I'm doing a crock pot challenge. If you listen to the show, and I'll talk about it all throughout the week, but if you listen to the show, you know that I went on a crock pot craze over the wintertime, the spring, really, March, April. I was trying to cook, learning how to cook. So crock pot. So many great people, Download Nation, sent me stuff, which was great. And I tried some of it. I had a corned beef cabbage that I did. Well, this week I was like putting some groceries away. I'm like, what is all this stuff? And it was just like us. I have a stack of like 6 or 7 Tupperware containers of mystery food because I'm not advanced enough to put a label on it. And so I said, this is my week. Since it's August, you know, let's try it. Let's bring it in and microwave it, put it on the old defrost, see what it is, and eat it for dinner. That's a very strange and somewhat dangerous task. But I truly don't know what they are. I think one I know is maybe a beef stew. The other one was like a Thai chicken. And the one I ate today, corned beef and cabbage.
Beef stew, corned beef and cabbage.
Beautiful.
Perfect for August.
Early August. But I got to get rid of them, right? I'm seriously sweating. I'm sweating from eating that.
If they held this long, will they not hold until another month or two when it's a little bit brisk?
You know what? I might as well get rid of them now.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like they're not. I feel like 4 months, 5 months, it's probably time to eat them. And it's a good time to do it right now. I don't know why, just because it's the dog days of August. And it's a good bit for the radio, so certainly I'll put it on my Instagram at Jay Coffs. And you can check it out. It's pretty gross. I just took it out of the Tupperware, and it's got the shape of the Tupperware, and it's like chunks of corned beef. News, weather, and traffic with Bob Kessler and Esmeralda Leon tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break, come back, do the carryout. Stay with us. Let's get to the carryout here on The Download. This is our nightly segment where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Donald Trump made a big speech in Detroit talking economics. The big takeaway? A tax cut, of course. Trump also maligned Clinton, saying her plan was to raise middle-class taxes, which is something she never said. But you know what? Fact-checking, that's for journalists, not the candidates. Look at it this way. If Trump told the truth all the time, news reporters, they'd be out of jobs. So in a way, Trump is making this speech for the economy. There you go. Viva da Trump. A new poll says Clinton is up 13 points. The CPS budget is out today. They cut about $230 mil from central administration and layoffs to get this, a balanced budget. The first in years, say CPS brass. The only problem is that assumes that the teachers union will accept the same terms that the union rejected earlier in the year. So essentially, a big middle finger to Karen Lewis and the CTU. Yeah, no, that usually works. Delta Airlines had a huge power failure that stranded passengers all over the world. I know, you know what? They should just give those passengers pretzels and maybe like a free charging station, maybe a voucher for an overhead bag, but I don't want to get too ahead of myself. That might be too crazy. You know what? The pretzels are probably fine. The Rio Olympics are underway, and I only noticed this because of the 15 channels of sport that have taken over my TV. Fencing? Sure, I'll watch fencing. No huge Zika killer bacteria stories yet, but two foreign boxers were arrested for sexual assault of a hotel maid. Sure, you live your entire life to make it to the Olympics and then lose your control when a maid brings new towels. Way to go, guys.
Suicide Squad came out this weekend, and it was so bad that it made $135 million. Some say the critics were predisposed not to like the movie because of the hype. Wait, isn't that what Hollywood is built on? The backs of writers and actors with a big old side of hype? Meh, I didn't see it. And if I did, somewhat recommended. Ugh. A beluga whale died at the Shedd Aquarium this weekend. You know what? It seems like we only hear about beluga whales in Chicago when they're born and when they die. I blame it on an anti-beluga media. Come on, where are the feel-good stories when the beluga goes to college? Or, you know, like the beluga's just having fun. Why can't we see those stories? Nah. Nah. Something's up. Burger King has set its sights on Chipotle. No, not with the mandatory hand washing, but for turning a Whopper into a burrito. The Whopperito will have the same ingredients of a Whopper, but wrapped in a flour tortilla. It'll be $2.99, which is about $4 less than the burrito at Chipotle, and about $1.99 grosser. In weather, August feels so good, right? It just feels good. In sports, the Olympics are in full swing. I should know I've watched so much whitewater rowing. The Polish team really messed up that rotation. Be ashamed of themselves. It's fun to watch for the locals. Connor Dwyer tonight, another kid from Naperville. Actually, you know, that's the joy of the Olympics, isn't it? When a random swimmer gets introduced and it says Naperville, Illinois under his name. Up to that point, you could care less, but now you're like, yeah, I think I'm going to stand up now. Come on, Travis, Tyler, Dakota, whatever your name is. Go swim! Beat the Japanese guy! Michael Phelps races again tonight. And if you think that some of the U.S. swimmers have chicken pox, no, it's just a goofy new muscle treatment called cupping. So no Zika, just cupping. Okay. The Cubs are quietly rolling, looking like the team that dominated at the start of the season. Jorge Soler is back in a big way, two homers in a sweep of the Oakland A's this weekend. The Cubs are 28 games above 500. Wow. They're off today, and they're going to get back at it tomorrow against Anaheim. The Sox got blown out yesterday to lose the series to the Orioles. James Shields got back to his form with a terrible outing. The Sox are now 5 games under .500, and they go to Kansas City tomorrow. Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod, retired, sort of. His last game will be on Friday, and then he's going to serve as a consultant to the team in 2017, which is code for how you exactly going to earn that $20 million a year? Throwing batting practice? Cool. Maybe he should do the sausage run or get in the San Diego chicken costume, too. I bet there's a bit there about growth hormones in your chicken, like something in there. I'm you know what? I'm not a writer for the Yankees. They got to figure it out themselves. The Bears get back to business in Bourbonnais after a terrible practice at Soldier Field Saturday. Starting center Hronis Grasu turned right and his knee turned left, and boom, ACL, he's out for the year. You know what? I wouldn't worry about it, though. Center, it's not that important. What's Olin Krutz doing? Still breaking jaws at the gun range? Get him back. Also, enough of the brawls. I guess backup center Ted Larson likes to fight. Isn't it like always the old white offensive lineman that likes to fight? I love the scrimmage fights against other teams, but your own team over and over? All right, it gets old. Alshon practiced a bit on the side today, so I think we're back, right? I think we're back, 13-3. Also, last night's Hall of Fame game between the Pack and the Colts was postponed because of a shoddy turf. Really? You can postpone games for that? If that were the case, we wouldn't play games at Soldier Field in all of December. And finally tonight, things are looking up off the coast of Cape Cod. Great white sharks have returned, and researchers are delighted. This is good for the ecosystem and the health of the species until they kill a human and we hunt them down like a video game. We're watching you, sharks. We're watching. Well, that's the carryout for August 8th, 2016. We, too, are doing everything in burrito style tonight. Chicken burritos, steak burritos, chocolate sundae burritos. I mean, think of the extra carbs. More to come tonight here on the Download. Touche! That's right, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy are here in studio to argue about politics, and what a day to argue about it. Today it's got to be about the economy. It's coming up after the news here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right.
That's right. It's time for Touché. It's Monday night here on the Download. In studio, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Seems like just yesterday you guys were here. What a week it's been.
on the campaign trail. We've seen what we saw last week. The polls start to dip a little bit, and then over the course of a week,
Wait a minute. We're not talking about Olympic swimming and all of the swimmers from,
that's right,
from Illinois
that's,
who
that's
are on the U.S.
half.
Olympic
that's
team?
That's the second half. Right?
From New Trier, no less.
We got let's talk about this because
all over the great state of
Politico puts out a poll today. Polls can go up and down, but they say a 13-point lead for Hillary Clinton. All of this because of foot-in-mouth disease for Donald Trump. What does this say about moving forward? What does Trump have to do to get back on board?
Okay.
So that
wait,
poll.
Wait, you're the Democrat.
You want to? Chris, you tell them.
It's a Trump.
You tell real Donald Trump what he has to do to get back on board.
As I did last week in my letter, and just by the way, everybody who spoke about this stuff for the rest of the week said things I said in my letter, which are very simple. Number one, he's got three things to talk about. He talks about Obama's economic failures, Clinton's foreign policy failures, and his vision of a better tomorrow for all Americans.
Those three things today in Detroit?
Yeah, today in Detroit, yes, he did. He didn't really get into foreign policy failures too much, but he did talk about Obama's economic failures, and he linked Hillary to Obama's economic policies, which I think is very fair. And he talked about a better economic future for all Americans. I think this was a good day until... David,
he just can't help himself. He was on message. He was getting a clean hit on the economy. And then somewhere around like 4 or 5 o'clock this afternoon, he decided he could not control himself any longer. I think that he was let out of protective custody or the straitjacket he was in. Or, no, you can't touch those, your thumbs. You can't touch your keyboard to tweet. And he responded.
Take that iPhone away from him.
So one of the amazing things that happened today was that 50 national security.
This is a big deal.
50 Republican senior
big
national
name.
Security, big name people from cabinet secretaries like Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff, national security advisors, national security folks.
My buddy, Gary Edson from New Trier. Way to go, Gary.
Chris's buddy, so it's important. letter
I got other
just
buddies on
rips Donald Trump to shreds in terms of his fitness for office. And I'll read you just one quick thing.
Oh, do you have to?
I must. From a foreign policy perspective, Donald Trump is not qualified to be president and commander-in-chief. Indeed, we are convinced that he would be a dangerous president and would put at risk our country's national security and well-being. And they conclude by saying, we are convinced that in the Oval Office, he would be the most reckless president in American history.
So this came out.
Where is the news?
He wasn't happy.
Where is the news?
The news really comes out and what Donald Trump goes after on Twitter
he's got this economic mojo going
for about 3 hours.
And so what did he say on Twitter?
So he went on Twitter and basically attacked and said that these people are trying to hold on to their power. These are the people that got us into the messes that we're in. These are the elites that are trying to take your money away from you or something. It was a long statement. It was a tweet.
Let me ask this, Chris. You know, that is the sentiment that Donald Trump seems to go back to. He goes back to the idea of these people are the establishment we're trying to replace. These people are worried they're not going to get their money if they don't get elected. Yes. Like all this kind of stuff. Does that resonate with the Trump voter, the people that seem to be his core?
Yeah, and that's one of the brilliant things about the Trump campaign. And when people criticize, it is validating. So whether it's Hillary Clinton saying he's unfit for office or 50 Republican bigwigs saying he's unfit for office, he's able to use Mao's term, and don't forget Mao was a professional philosopher before he turned into a mass murderer.
We're not going to forget that.
Forget that. Mao wrote one of his four great essays was called On the Negation of the Negation. And Trump is able to take something like an incoming Scud missile from Hillary Clinton and basically in the eye of the Trump beholder, right? In the eye of the folks who love him dearly and who think he is the answer, and he's the only one with the answer, he's able to deflect that back, you know, he thinks and his base thinks right back at Hillary.
Well, unlike Chris, who wants to quote Chinese communists for his support, I'll quote an American. P.T. Barnum, all press is good press, as long as you spell his name right. And it worked in the primary. He dominated the news cycle. It's not working now. It's backfiring.
But you guys have been around a long time.
It's not working now. Let's be specific. It is not working since the start of the Democratic convention, and it is not working. I was on TV the morning of the first day of the Democratic convention, and you know, Trump was winning almost all of the key states, and he was winning the total, the big average on Real Clear Politics by about a point and a half, almost 2 points.
That for was a the brief shining moment.
That was the high watermark. Exactly. That was the high watermark of his support. And since then, it's been a kind of an erosion, a slow erosion, but it's been going in one direction. And he has to turn that around if he's going to be viable.
But here's the thing. And listeners to this show have heard me say this for 6 months. I made a bold prediction. I said Trump is going to lose this race by 12 points. And everybody's looking at me like I'm on crack. There's something wrong with me. And I said it's a very simple calculus. At a certain point, the American people start to look at somebody as a potential commander in chief. And Donald Trump will be viewed as illegitimate, as the guy with his finger on the button. Now, I didn't think it was going to happen this quickly. And en masse, all these Republicans were the ones, because it's not just these 50. You had Barry McCaffrey, four-star general Barry McCaffrey. You had Michael Morell, the former director of the CIA, who served both Republican and Democratic presidents.
Who's gone to the dark side.
And a lot of people who've never made a partisan comment in their professional careers are now coming out to say, hey, this is bad.
Wouldn't I say this, though, you know, trying to play devil's advocate here, that the establishment, Republicans and Democrats in this situation, are not necessarily where the fight is. It's establishment and non-establishment, people who want to see something change. So Republicans coming out and saying, signing a letter for 50 saying Trump is unfit, that's not necessarily going to affect a voter who wants to blow up.
Well,
not literally, but wants to, you know, take apart the system that we do right
now. Well, the Trumpian version of the Sanders revolution.
Right.
Sanders
right.
kept talking revolution is the Trumpian version. Well, I think this, there is an enormous center of gravity in the Republican establishment to do everything possible to get rid of Trump by the 10th of September. And they are going to keep working it, and they are going to keep trying it. And what we
and
see
why
here,
the 10th of September?
Because they can slate a different candidate.
Because by 10 September, they can slate another candidate, give or take. That's not a definitive.
I think that's so interesting.
But they are there. Those guys are, and ladies, those men and women are absolutely dedicated. And he is on thin ice. I mean, he's on no ice with them, but he is on thin ice. His weakness is fundraising.
Well, obviously, I mean, if he's going to be going against the establishment, that's when the establishment is figuring out a way to have all the money in politics. So we'll see how that plays out.
He just raised a huge amount of money last month, but he doesn't know what to do with it because he has no campaign infrastructure. He has nobody to place national media. Hillary is advertising in the Olympics with some great commercials, by the way, tens of millions of dollars. Donald Trump has $0 currently at play in the battleground states. Zero.
And he's still, I mean, notwithstanding Politico.
13 points today.
I know, 13 points. But he is not extinguished. He could come back.
But here's one quick point. The most important point out of that poll today from Monmouth, which 538.com rates as an A-plus pollster, the most important point that they made is that in 2012, Romney had a +6 among college-educated women, college-educated white women. In this poll, he is -30.
Yeah. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, Touche. We'll be right back.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go right,
you go right. Touche here on the download. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. Talking about the campaign for president 2016. At some point or another, we'll talk about some of the down ballot stuff, but this is just too juicy. Dave Lundy, let's turn the table for just a second. What do you do if you're a candidate in August with a 13-point lead?
Well, first of all, you act like you're behind. There's an old saying, if your opponent is down on the mat, you keep your foot on their throat until they're dead.
Dead. Especially, I'll have them dead. Especially I want their heart burned to the ground.
When you have somebody as
That's
vicious as Donald
way.
Trump. That is the Chicago way. Yeah. You just keep him down. You don't give him any airtime. You don't let him up. So on the one hand, you keep attacking, you keep delegitimizing him. I say that word, I've said that word, delegitimize Donald Trump as a commander in chief. So that's number one. Number two, you have to present your vision for the future. One of the really interesting thinks
taxes,
about
more the, government.
One of the really
bigger
interesting
regulation.
Things about the Democratic convention
lower income
was that
everybody.
Hillary Clinton was able
That's
to erase
vision.
Many of the character flaws that she has in the minds of the public by doing a much better job on her proactive, positive message. She's never going to restore 100%. You know, she's never going to get to plus 50 on the trust thing.
No,
too much water under the bridge.
Well, too many lies.
But what she can do. lies, unlike the Hillary Clinton is aren't going to raise taxes on the middle class, which Donald Trump turned
Hillary
into. We are going to raise taxes on the middle class.
We can come to a common ground here on Touche and
common
say
ground.
They both lie. How about that?
Can Hillary lies about important stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Who cares if Donald Trump actually met Putin in the green room? No one cares.
Yeah, who cares about Donald Trump's relationship with Russia?
Hillary lies.
Nobody cares.
Hillary lies about her relationship with Russia, and she gave them control of all of the uranium mines in the world.
All right, here we go. We're getting deep into
So what you're talking about.
There's some .NET.
Wait. Let me adjust my tinfoil hat here.
Get your tinfoil out. I want to tell you.
Well,
that
what
Trump,
do you do? In your case, if you're Hillary Clinton's up 13
things,
points. What do
three
you
things. He has got to talk about his vision for the future. He's got to talk about the Obama economic failures. That is the only thing you should talk about. Obama economic
Does it
failures.
Hurt? Does it hurt when you get good job
and then, and the third is.
Out?
He has to talk about the legacy of conflict, really. The legacy of conflict from Hillary's time at the State Department.
Okay, I get that. But as the voter, the United States voter, don't they recognize that conflict seems to come with every president? I mean, we had an Iraq war and a 9/11 on a Republican president's watch. Does it also, the same when you talk about economic policy, does it hurt that movement for Donald Trump when job numbers come out month by month they're going up?
No, the job numbers the month before were going down, and I mean
they didn't
go up significantly.
They were up 289,000.
No, the month earlier it was about 150. And the more important point is that we are teetering very close to recession because the revised economic growth figures were down at 1.2%, which is really this is the weakest recovery in history, except for that,
you
which
don't
took
go
place
into a
under,
recession creating 255,000 jobs. I'm sorry,
me.
You just don't.
It's not; those are not very good jobs. And the definition of a recession.
Oh, I see.
The definition of a recession, which I'm sure you didn't learn in college because you weren't an economics major like some people, is two straight quarters of flat or negative growth.
It's negative growth, actually, Mister. I learned this in college. Apparently, you didn't. No, it's negative growth.
So what you
and we're not going to have two consecutive quarters. And by the way, even if we did, there's 90 days left to the election. It's too late.
The point here is that Barack Obama's recovery has been the weakest since the Great Depression, and Hillary wants more taxes on the people. She wants more debt for our balance sheet, and Hillary wants
as
more government and more regulation.
But I mean, that sounds talking pointy because I can go
to
Dave Lundy and he could say Donald Trump wants to raise taxes.
Did you listen to her in Philadelphia? She is talking about all kinds of new taxes. She's got three categories of new taxes, and she has no address. She is not addressing. In any
don't
sense,
don't those taxes
the
resonate
problem.
With the idea of the haves and the have-nots? I mean, most everything that is being pushed to the American people is tax on the rich, tax on the millionaire tax. I mean, you're seeing it in commercials. So when you say taxes, it's a little disingenuous to say that this is just the Democrats. What they usually will say is we want to see the rich taxed.
I think Donald Trump went out of his way
to change that rhetoric today, and that's what everyone's saying that's wrong. That's fact-checking.
I think there is no way for Hillary to get to her ultimate deficit impact without expanding the impact of that tax over the middle class.
As opposed to what Donald Trump proposed today, which is to cut taxes on absolutely everybody.
Let me tell you.
Gutting taxes on everybody and cutting the deficit. Voila. Let's revert to Donald Trump's famous... magic wand.
Let me tell you exactly what happened in New York City when Rudy Giuliani did the same thing with corporate taxes that Donald Trump proposed today. Rudy Giuliani took over in New York City. He said one of our biggest problems is all of the corporations that employ people are leaving the city. All of our rents are going down because nobody wants to have their offices here. And so he immediately cut taxes for corporations in New York. Everybody said this is going to ruin. Right. This is a favor to the rich. It's a favor to the wealthy. It's not going to do anything for the regular people, and it's going to ruin our balance sheet. Here's what happened.
Meet the new supply sider, same as the old one.
He went from $2.5 billion deficit for the unified budget of New York City to a 3.5 unified surplus. That was a swing of 600,000 new jobs, and it became
during
the top
Clinton expansion
destination.
So, there you go. So that makes sense. If he can get that kind of success that Giuliani had in New York, then that's something that he should roll on. Let's 1 minute to go here. I'm interested in what you think is going to happen this week. We saw the economic speech today. Hillary Clinton goes to the same room to talk on Thursday. What do we expect from her, and do we expect any curveballs?
I have a bold prediction. U.S. will win gold in men's basketball. Okay? That's what's going to happen this
week.
Bold.
I think she's going to give a talk, and it's going to be about more taxes and more regulation. And I think the economic talk that Trump gave today, even though he stepped on his own story by going out there against the 50 foreign policy people, that economic story is going to serve him well in the weeks ahead.
That economic story was the old Republican talking points. It was Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. It was supply side economics. It's been discredited year after year, decade after decade. It's not going to fly. And by the way, what he didn't mention today in his economic address was that he proposed these massive tariffs on trade, which economists of both parties have said are going to cost 3.5 million American jobs.
Lundy comes right at the end. Touche, get you
touche.
Those
are the talking points. Democrat talking points. To be continued.
Talking points.
Touche.
Dave
touché.
Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. Touche every Monday night. We'll catch you back here next Monday. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Rob Elder's going to be here, longtime writer and journalist here in town. He and a couple other writers put together a book called Hidden Hemingway, and it's really digging into the archives of Hemingway in Oak Park, the birthplace of Ernest Hemingway. So we're going to talk with Rob Elder. Also, Doug Plank's going to join us, former number 46 for the Chicago Bears, talk about what we can expect from the preseason game coming up this week. Also, Doug's going to join us every Monday night here on WGN Radio. So excited. It's so great, Pete, to have a moment where the newspaper says, hey, Doug Plank's going to be on the radio every Monday. It was a nice announcement tonight and today in Rob Feeder's column. So not every day. We'll take it, right? It's worth a clap. Pete's clapping in the studio. All right, so that's all coming up tonight. My guest at the big table, poet and author. His new novel is called How to Set a Fire and Why. Jesse Ball is the author of 14 books, most recently the novel How to Set a Fire and Why. The New York-born writer came to Chicago to join the faculty at the School of the Art Institute. There he taught writing. He continues to teach. He also teaches classes on walking, dreams, lying without judgment. Really great stuff. Jesse won the 2008 Paris Review Plimpton Prize. He was longlisted for the National Book Award, and he has been a Guggenheim Fellow. His new novel is getting great reviews. And Jesse Ball is my guest tonight at the big table. Jesse, nice to meet you.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm happy that you took some time to come down here. Let's talk about the novel. This is really a departure for you in a way, but I say that because all of your novels are kind of a departure.
Well, this book, I guess there's a perspective that it's a departure because it's different from the other books. It's just one voice, narrator, who's a teenage girl, Lucia Stanton, and she sort of, the book is just her speaking about her life, you know, so it's simple, it's very easy to read, straightforward.
For you, I mean, it's an interesting, when I say it's a departure, I mean, I'm interested in the way that you, I see you have 14 books, and some of that is prose, some of that is poetry, some of that novels, of course, but you've done a good job in your career of sort of not just sort of settling on one genre, one style. Is that on purpose?
Definitely. I mean, essentially, I'm a very practical person. And so each book has a goal. And perhaps in one book, it might be to write about ambiguity or about the feeling of, in our lives, passage through time. And these things are more complicated if you want to, you know, in a painterly way, if you want to etch that or create that, it requires a kind of a structure to do that. in the case of Lucia Stanton and How to Set a Fire and Why, I wanted to paint the feelings of a teenage girl confronted with this absurd spectacle that we have to live in. And so the right tool for that was this single, unbroken voice sort of shouting out of her, you know, deeply held views with her heart.
You know, it's, she is an interesting character because, and not to give away too many points of the book, but she, you know, grows up without a father. Her mother is mentally ill or not there. But she's sort of attracted to and seeks out fire. Talk about that, the idea of the arson club and you know, Lucia's sort of push toward, not to say push, but I would say sort of being drawn to that.
Life nowadays is very, very confusing because identity, you know, we grow up and our identities are not just embedded in what we do and the world that's around us with the people that are around us, but also the internet and our wealth and our belongings. And we mistake these things for being who we actually are. And fire is this thing which, as a, you know, principally anti-materialistic weapon, can free a person from. I mean, of course, there are many arguments for and against burning things, but at least in this book, for Lucia Stanton, the idea is that fire is a way to turn this civilization she herself has been discarded by, to turn it into rubble.
And there's something political in the book, just the idea that, you know, the choices to, you know, to set things on fire are almost, you know, to set the playing field, equal it out.
Yes, definitely.
Is that how you set out? I mean, you set out to write a political book?
Actually, I can only write when I feel completely surprised. So when I sit down to write a book, I generally have a very slim and slender notion of what the book will be. And if I'm going to write a page and be in it, writing it, enjoying the writing of it, being delighted by it, and I feel that it must be that way if the writing is going to be any good, I have to be delighted by it. It's not some, you know, tough slog writing. For me, it's a beautiful delight. I have to be surprised. And so otherwise, why would I continue? Why do I walk down the street? To be surprised by things and to learn anew on each street who I am, a person I hadn't met before.
Are you the kind of writer who writes the way you live? Meaning, you know, you just mentioned, you know, you walk down the street hoping to be surprised. You write hoping to be surprised. I mean, do you live your life the same way that you write down your ideas?
I try to. I would certainly love to succeed in that. I think I have ambitions to be a certain kind of person, and I'm constantly failing. Many of us are, right? But it's there's always another day.
I just, you know, and a lot of your writing does... You seem to be a writer who is in step with you know who you are, and life is not always about who you are. There's a lot of mundane parts of waking up and drinking coffee and, you know, turning on television or whatever.
Take coffee very seriously.
You take coffee very seriously. How do you find yourself being able to continue that duality, that idea that you're living a life to surprise when that mundane sort of it just has to creep into all of our lives?
I think a mistaken notion has crept into this. My life is extremely boring. So all of these boring things you describe are part and parcel of this you know, exercise of surprise. I want to be surprised. They're very slight things, very subtle things, you know, just how I feel, you know, as I go and I sit in the same chair that I sat in 100 times before, how it feels a little bit different today. You know, it's very minor things. It's a kind of poverty of ideas in which beautiful things can be discovered.
Talking with Chicago author Jesse Ball, his new book, How to Set a Fire and Why, is out now, getting great reviews. He's also on the faculty at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. And I got to ask you about labels, because this is one thing I noticed that many people will always sort of say, oh, he's one of the best experimental writers working today. And I always wonder for someone who's a true experimental writer if that title is just kind of bogus. We'll talk more with Jesse coming up. Stay with us. Chopping at the bit to get back at it. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest, Jesse Ball, author, novelist. His new book, How to Set a Fire and Why, is out now, getting great reviews. He's a faculty member at the School of the Art Institute here in Chicago as well. Moved here in 2007. That's why you came to Chicago, right?
That's true.
Yeah. What drew you here?
I was living in Iceland before that and just trying to make ends meet, and it's a great job. So I moved here with my Icelandic wife and child.
Yeah. Really? And what did you know about Chicago at that time? Because you're from New York. You grew up in New York, right?
I was from New York, but I had never visited Chicago. I flew through it once, I think. Yeah.
What did you know about? What did you think about Chicago?
Well, I told my wife at the time that it was going to be a distinctly American adventure, because I really feel Chicago is one of the only of the great cities of America. It's the only American city. New York's not really an American city. LA is not really an American city. San Francisco, but Chicago is an American.
It's an American city. That's right. We're sitting in an American studio here on Michigan Avenue. You know, I mentioned right before the break that the title you usually get, they say Jesse Ball is an experimental writer. What does that mean?
Essentially, well, there are different ways that it's used. You know, sometimes it's used pejoratively, and sometimes it's used in a sort of unabashedly admiring way. I think depending upon if someone is using it as an insult, they just mean it's the work you're doing is not really to be read. You know, it's some kind of posture, you know. And I hope that's not the case with my work. When it's said in an admiring way, it just means that the work has some, in some way, it is delightful. It does the things that a real book should do. But as well, it looks a little strange, you know. And I feel like, I don't know, I told you before, I'm a practical person. I don't really want to read anything unless I feel like it will change me. I want to be moved to tears by a book. I want to be changed. And so the books, sometimes they'll look a little strange because they have a very distinct purpose. You know, a wrench looks really strange. A fork looks strange. Hmm. You know, they have purposes.
How often, are you seeking out those moments or those books that are going to change or going to change you? I mean, is that sort of, you have to put some research into that, because I was going to say there's probably a lot of books you get halfway through and you're like, oh, this didn't do it.
I'm ruthless. I have a test. I go into a bookstore, pick up a book. I open it at random to three different places. And if each of those three pages is mesmerizing, I'll buy it. If not, toss it.
Yeah. How much of a reader are you? I mean, as a writer, do you find yourself reading a lot of other works? Or are you writing reading for fun, reading for routine?
Well, of course, there's a lot of reading that's pressed upon you. I think one of the strange things about really loving books is that you love books you've already read. So I'm a big rereader. Probably half my reading is just reading things that I love. You know, that I read long ago, reading them again and again and again, you know.
And do you find new things that either you forgot or you missed the first time through? Or is it just really the ritual of sort of living it again?
I have a terrible memory. I'm surprised by the books. The cliffhanger endings will always get me.
They will get you second time or third time around. For you, I read somewhere that the writing process for you is fast. That you're not a writer who's going to, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, slog through some stuff, that you get an idea or start the writing process and you're done within a week, week and a half. Talk about that.
If you think about the time that it takes to type something, you know, the idea of just if you were to type out a whole book, it wouldn't take ultimately that long to do, you know. So essentially, when I go to write a book, I have an idea. Something, usually it's an image or a scene. In this case with Lucia, it was a phrase, the first sentence. I had a feeling about this character, and I felt there were just limitless possibilities within her, and I wanted to spend some time with her. So I sat down and I began writing. And it does take, you know, about a week usually to write these books. They're not long books, maybe 300 pages or something, you know, for a novel. But one of the reasons that I do it faster sometimes, I think, than other people do, is that I don't really take very much back. I feel like if I say a thing and it is embarrassing to me, or I'm wrong, you know, or it displays some kind of intellectual flaw, I'm comfortable with that. You know, I'm comfortable.
Do you have, I would say, your crew around you, editors, and they've talked about this in different places, you know, will come back to you and say, you got to work on this part, you got to work on that part. Do you usually say, try to keep that at arm's length?
Yeah, I try to hold myself, you know, I try to hold myself to the text as it was originally written. And the reason is that in some sense, that's going to be the clearest way that those thoughts can be passed from one person to another.
You seem to, thoughts and ideas seem to be a crucial way that you communicate with your words. You know, you don't necessarily think of it as necessarily writing, but really just about expressing ideas.
The idea that there's a fundamental difference between fiction, nonfiction, poetry, all of these, it's sort of just, it's a silly distinction, ultimately. And it has more to do with just taste, like someone wants to read a kind of thing and they can go and find it. But ultimately, as we know, as everyone knows, right, newspapers, nonfiction, it's full of lies, you know. And then fiction is also sometimes full of truth and vice versa, you know.
Is there, there's really no, I guess, genre that you'll shy away from?
I've written nonfiction, poetry, fiction. I'll write anything, God forbid.
But I mean, let's get back to this concept around the idea. Because, you know, just sort of, I mean, I was really moved just reading some of the stuff that you've put out, but also, like, you know, just the way that you approach the craft. I mean, you really are about that. I'm trying to remember exactly the quote, but it was this: books are not books, they're ideas, or they're just like theater is an idea or a play is an idea. Talk about that, the sort of communication of an idea and this being almost like a vessel for that.
There are two things that I look for when I pick up a book, things that I love to find in a book. One is the company of another mind. And so the company of that mind is most profound when it's sort of most germane to itself, most its own quintessence, which is why I don't want to revise the thing. I want it to simply be the experience of my mind as it was set down on the page. And then the second thing that I gain from reading a book is these shapes of thoughts as they're embedded in sentences. And I feel gaining those shapes of thoughts makes me capable of dealing with life's tragedies as I go along, you know. So the company of beautiful minds and new thought shapes, it's a practical reason to read. I would never read something just to be entertained. To me, it's useless.
And you know, you've mentioned this before, just the idea of tragedy or being able to write and to read as a way to, I guess, process tragedy? Is that how you would explain it?
To process it and to take precaution against it.
Yeah, okay.
We know it will come, you know. I'm going to ride my bicycle back to my house after this, and I might go underneath the bus. Who knows?
So you're, in a way, your thoughts and ideas and the tragedies that are embedded, that could happen. It could happen in your writing, but your writing almost shies away to celebrate the fact that it doesn't.
I do try to celebrate joy and to celebrate life, but the books are generally pretty sad, you know?
Yeah. where does that come from? As a writer, where does that sadness come from? Does it come from your personal experience? Does it come from the way you see the world now?
It's just, I don't want to waste anyone's time. And I feel that the principal fact about the world is this onslaught of grief. And yet, despite the existence of such grief, the constant upswelling of joy in the companionship of other people.
You're really bumming us out here. No. Jesse Ball is my guest. How to Set a Fire and Why is the novel that's out right now. You know, there's so much more to talk about. There's a great photo in the Chicago Magazine piece of you standing in front of pages and pages and pages pasted on the wall of your manuscripts. And I've read other places that you have manuscripts as far as the eye can see and the fact that are not published. Are you writing constantly? Are you the kind of writer who's just like, okay, I've got this idea, I'm going to put this down, and then you've sort of got a backlog of stuff?
I do have a backlog. it happens that nowadays I will write maybe once or twice a year, you know, and not much more than that. But in the past, I've written, you know, several books in 1 year. I think it isn't, I mean, you always hope to be received and be beloved in your time and have people love your work. But the reason for doing work is not necessarily to, you know, be feted and, mm-hmm. and known. You do work for its own sake.
For your sake or for the work's sake?
For your sake, yeah. Because life can be so bleak and depressing. And by writing and by finding this sort of celerity of words on the page, you free things up a little, shake things up a little, and it becomes possible to see the grace that exists in each moment.
For you, how important is it to have a schedule? Do you keep a schedule when you write? I mean, you just said one or two times per year, but and in the past you've just sort of written when you've written. But how, as you get older, how important is it to have a schedule?
Well, I guess one thing I should be clear about is that the main thing that I schedule and the main thing that I, or the disciplines that I require of myself and fail at constantly, these disciplines I'm always failing at, are to encourage a quality of mind in my daily life. And so I don't write very often. Then when I do write, I just write down what comes to mind. You know, so essentially that work of revision is just happening mm-hmm. every day by surrounding myself with people that I love, by trying to and by trying not to shield myself from things like walking around the entire city, bicycling around the entire city, meeting all kinds of people, by trying to live as vivid a life as possible. You know, that's the thing that I desperately try to do and fail at, you know.
But you try, and that's a lot better than most of us, right? Jesse Ball's new novel is How to Set a Fire and Why. The faculty member at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago is a former Guggenheim Fellow, also long-listed for the National Book Award, Paris Review, Plimpton Prize. Let's continue the conversation. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. I'd love to talk to you about your work at the School of the Art Institute, which, you know, I've read people, writers who want come to Chicago to write with you, to be under your tutelage. So we'll talk more with Jesse about that here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin, my guest in studio, Jesse Ball. Jesse, the author of the book How to Set a Fire and Why. It's getting great reviews right now, just came out. It's also on the faculty of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago here. Creative fiction? What do you write or what do you teach at the School of Art Institute?
The program is a program, it's an MFAW, so a master's in writing.
Master's in writing. And one of the things that seems to be pulled out is the diversity in what you teach, because you're not just teaching creative fiction one or like that's not how the School of the Art Institute works, but there's, you know, everything from dreams to a course on walking to a course on lying. Where did these ideas come from?
Well, when I was hired to teach writers and improve their writing, I thought, you know, I could potentially force them to read books, kind of whip them, make mm-hmm. them read books, or I could force them to write long things and, you know, whip them and make sure that they had done it. But it seems like if a writer has the passion to do that, they're going to read books, they're going to write anyway.
Right.
You know,
so this is an MFA program, right?
So I thought, well, what can I do? And I said, well, there are writers who are boring and there are writers who are more interesting. So if my classes just made the people in them more interesting, that would be sufficient to improve the writing. It's just the writing becomes more interesting if the person becomes more interesting. So then the classes just are about an engagement with life. You know, lucid dreaming is an engagement with your dreams and with controlling them. Walking, you learn about the city you live in. You know, so often we go about our lives unconsciously, and then to go walk out into the city.
Just from this interview alone, that's a huge part of why you write. Yeah. Is this sort of this idea of walking through life and what's around the other corner. And the other thing that I think works when you take on things like walking or lucid dreaming or lying is that you do have the shared mind. You get, you know, the writers are in the class and they get the opportunity to bounce ideas off each other. And there's something in that experience that, that, you know, does exactly what you were talking about in what you choose to read, right?
Absolutely. Each week I'll give out exercises and I just send them out into the city and they do these exercises and all the students come back. And then the first hour of class, we're just sharing what happened. You know, here's what happened in our lives. And it's wonderful for people to have news that they can pass back and forth, you know, of their exploits, adventures.
Where do you come up with the ideas for this? I mean, obviously lucid dreaming, but lying is one that I'm intrigued by. What was the genesis or what was the reason to have a class about lying?
That was the first class I taught when I came here. And I guess I feel there's a great deal of misconceptions about lying that exist, you know, in culture, sort of demonized. And I think we lie all the time. Everyone's always lying, but some of the lies are deemed sort of a no-fly zone, mm-hmm. whereas other ones are embraced, you know. And I think that can make, if you imagine writing a book to be, you're writing a series of statements that are either true or false, mm-hmm. you know. If you don't really have the script straight about how lies work in society, it's difficult to write a really crystalline book.
You know? And is that part of what you're teaching with that class, is how to sort of see the patterns of lies? Or and also I saw lying without judgment.
Yes. I also teach them to lie better, to go out and lie. And
always good.
And there are contests. We'll have contests where you try to detect other people's lies, things like this.
And yeah. But you've mentioned this before, that, you know, because you get interviewed about this a lot. But there is something about, I mean, lying is a big part of fiction writing. I mean, that there's almost, they come from the same place.
Well, not just fiction writing, but identity. The assertion of identity often begins in a lie. You know, there was a day in your life when you were not a radio personality and you said, I would like to be, and you began to pretend in your heart that you were, and now look at you, you know.
So lying, continue to lie, trust me.
At the beginning, but things begin, you know, a hermit begins by pretending to be a hermit, you know, and I think that's not something that's wrong. It's just the beginning.
I guess you're right, because the word lie has such negative connotations, but I mean the word pretend does not.
Right.
The word fantasy does not. But I mean, so is it just the way that you sort of, you know, sort of the paradigm in which you're looking at this?
It has to do sometimes with your relationship to the lie. So if you tell a self-aggrandizing lie, like if you talk about your immense skill at basketball or something, you know, and actually you're just okay, you know, but you're bragging to someone, mm-hmm. you could just try to get away with that and have people respect you more, you know, from this one conversation. Or you could look at that and say, I really in my heart want to be a person who's good at basketball. I keep lying about this. Maybe I should go take some lessons. I should go practice more. I should become that person, you know?
Right.
So it can be a kind of barometer for who you want to be, who you hope to be.
And in some way, a motivation.
Yeah, and definitely a motivation. Yeah.
So for you, I mean, coming from Iceland to come to Chicago to be a part of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which is a great school here, and do the kind of classes you're talking about, Was this a dream for you? I mean, the idea of coming here and being able to do this kind of thing to shape young minds who are coming through, but also be able to write at this level?
It's an interesting question. I've taught for 9 years, and last year I wrote a book about teaching, which was published called Notes on My Dunce Cap. But when I came here to teach, I had never taught, really. This was the absolute beginning of my teaching. And furthermore, I always had a great deal of difficulty with being a student. I was a horrible student from the get-go. I was in special ed in Port Jefferson, Long Island, growing up. Had a terrible time.
Really? What was it? Learning disability?
I was extremely hyperactive. And I was suspended in you know, high school. I was a terrible student in college, just horrible from the get-go. You would never suspect I'd become a professor. But I think that it made me really feel that there's only one thing that needs to happen each semester, and that's in the course of the semester, the teacher has to reach each student completely, really reach each student once, just once, and that's sufficient, you know. To really attempt to give that person the gift of your ideas just once.
Just once. You know? I mean, thinking back to that, I mean, we've talked a lot about, you know, journeys and what's around the corner and surprises. I mean, does it surprise you looking back, if you can look back through the lens of that kid, you know, who was in New York, who, you know, was getting suspended in high school, to think where you're at now? I mean, an accomplished author, a past Guggenheim fellow, a professor at the School of Art Institute of Chicago. I mean, countless and countless, not only works of art and, you know, fiction and nonfiction, but also just, I mean, tremendous esteem. What do you say to that?
I wouldn't believe it. I would think you were pulling my leg.
I was lying.
And maybe you are.
That could be, man. You never know, right? Pull the curtain back on your whole life, right? But I mean, so what's next for you? I mean, you've got these manuscripts that haven't been published. Is the goal to publish them? I mean, is the goal to say each one of these is going to have their place in time?
Well, a book that I wrote the year before last, which is called Census, is actually, it's about my brother, who, he's been dead for quite some time now. He died in the late 90s. He had Down syndrome, and I realized I had never written about a character with Down syndrome, and I really wanted to. Feel like it's about time that there's a beautiful work of fiction that has such a character.
I thought it was interesting, you know, about your growing up, and you talk a lot about your brother and how, you know, having to be in the hospital and a lot of times fending for yourself. So that meant you had to read, that you draw back to that moment as a point of interest in the written word.
Definitely in the written word, but also just in perception. You know, I think it's sort of a deep philosophical point, whether it's better to have an extreme discrimination between objects. You know, maybe you imagine that the spectrum of colors, you could imagine it to be just 10 colors, or you could imagine it to be 150 or 2,000. You know, it just becomes more and more specific, you know. And or just one color, just everything be one, or someone with a grayscale sight, you know, be different. And so that's how it is with color. But what about all objects in the world having a similar kind of spectrum, a similar discrimination between this kind of person, that kind of person, this kind of feeling, that kind of feeling? My sense with my brother is that his act of discrimination was a more synergistic kind of thing. He would feel the relationships between things more than like this and that are separate. Mm. And so I have taken that as a deep lesson, a corrective to my constant. I'm very analytical and strategic. And so I take his heart as a corrective to my specificity.
Jesse Ball is my guest tonight. His new novel, How to Set a Fire and Why, it's getting great reviews. Faculty member at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Jesse, I can't thank you enough for coming in. Thanks for sharing your story, and good luck with the rest of your career. You got to come back.
Thank you so much.
All right, back at it here. How great was that? I love that guy, Jesse Ball. What a interesting guy and approach, and that's why I was very excited to talk to him. How to Set a Fire and Why is the book. It's great. A novel that's out right now. And he's, you know, he's doing a lot of work in Chicago, which I'll give him a lot of credit. He, like I said, 14 novels. Not just novels. There's some poetry, some prose, things like that. But I love that. I love the idea of, you know, just having a sort of cerebral conversation about where we live and how we live and that kind of thing. I'll take that all day. Programming note, Varsity, the band, canceled for Studio 435, so I could have kept him. I should have kept him. We could have talked for 2.5 hours taking calls about the fragility of life. Would you be down with that? Instead, what we're going to do is talk Olympics, which I'm very excited about. Molly Green's going to fan jam the Olympics. We can't watch them tonight because we're on the air doing a show. So she's going to watch. She's going to let us know what's the big moments, what's the funny moments, how many divers showered. A lot of showering divers today. Something to be said about showering and divers. There's a lot of that going on from what I saw. Right now it's just a sweeping picture of a pool. So that's always good. So that's all coming up tonight. We'll do that at 10 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, we'll have Doug Plank on. I'm very excited to talk to Doug Plank. Good old number 46. It'd be good. We'll talk to him. He was obviously in Rob Feeder's column today. He's going to be joining us here on the Download on WGN for the next, what, 18, 19, 20, 21? I mean, when's the Super Bowl? In February? He's going to join us Mondays till the Super Bowl, till the Bears win the Super Bowl. How about that? All right, why don't we talk some football?
Let's talk about football and your Chicago Bears. Down, set, punt, or will they punt? Can we get to the Super Bowl, or will we choke? It's the Bears Camp Report with Adam Hoge.
Love to download, don't you? It's like from esoteric literature to Chicago Bears training camp. Joining me now on the line, Adam Hoge, WGN Radio Sports. You can check it out at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Adam, okay, so we are without a starting center. That's not a good thing to be talking about in the second week of camp.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, a couple weeks ago, I think most Bears fans wouldn't have been all that upset about Hronis Grasu going down for the year. I mean, you never want to see a guy get hurt, but let's be honest, he wasn't that great last year in his rookie season. But, you know, I was skeptical, too, kind of going into the season about how much, you know, they were talking him up and saying, no,
he's a little undersized. Yeah, right.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I remember talking to him back in OTAs, and I had a great conversation with him at Hallis Hall a couple months ago where, he was so honest with me and said, you know, all this talk about my weight and how I'm not, you know, big enough. Yeah, I'm putting on weight and working on that, but a lot of the problems I had last year was not really understanding the playbook and really being out there too early. And I think people forget that he was a third-round pick who was really supposed to be redshirted for a year. I think the Bears took him where he was because they saw the upside, but he wasn't necessarily ready to go as a rookie. And because Will Montgomery got hurt last year, he was forced into duty early on. And, you know, I think he went through some growing pains. And I think in the Bears' mind, they really thought that, you know, the start of year two was when he could take over a center. He'd be bigger. He'd understand the game a little bit more, and it would all work out. And all, you know, yes, it's just training camp, but things were going really well for him down here in Bourbonnais. He looked bigger, he looked stronger, he was looking very good in one-on-one drills, which I put a lot of weight into here in training camp when they had the pads on. So for him to go down the way he did on Saturday at Soldier Field with a non-contact torn ACL, you know, it's tough too, especially because he's a guy you root for. He's a really nice kid. Really put in the work, and I know his teammates love him. So this was a tough one.
Let me ask you, what's the contingency plan? I mean, they are still in camp. There's probably going to be some cutdowns, maybe some veterans released. But right now, Ted Larson steps in. But is he the fix?
Well, I think they hope he is. Now, Ted Larson's kind of been your swing guard down here in camp. When Kyle Long was out for a while, at the start of camp, he was in there at right guard. He was working at left guard back in OTAs before Cody Whitehair was ready to go. And actually, Larson dealt with an injury during OTAs that kind of pushed him out of the starting lineup, at least working with the first team. And that's when they moved Cody Whitehair in there. And Whitehair's, I mean, a second-round pick, rookie, he's going to be starting right away. And I think he's a little bit more pro-ready than Grasu was a year ago. So Whitehair is going to be your left guard most likely. And Larson is going to be at center. And I think the reason why they're going with that instead of Whitehair, because Whitehair could play center, is I think they just like what Whitehair's doing at left guard. Mm-hmm. He played tackle in college, so it's only moving over one spot. He's already been working there. You don't want to make him learn a new position all of a sudden. Now, that being said, and Larson's a veteran who can probably deal with it a little bit better, if Larson were to go down, I think Whitehair is your next center, and I'm basing that off the fact that Whitehair has still been working he's still been taking some reps at center, really once the third or fourth team gets out there. He does take some reps every day in that spot, and he is still kind of learning that position just in case. So the bottom line here is the depth on the offensive line as we sit here on August 8th.
It's already in question.
Very thin. And that's scary.
Yeah, it's funny because they spent so much time bringing in free agents and they seem to retire or get hurt right away. I mean, as a Bears fan and as a football fan, tell us the importance of that position of center. I mean, there's line checks. I don't know how the Bears do it, and I know over time they've changed things up because they haven't had the talent in the right spot. And the second part to that question is, you know, on Friday we were talking about how it felt good that the Bears were finally, you know, having the right guys for the right position. They weren't mixing and matching and moving guys around, but the loss of Grasso seems like we're back to that stage again.
Yeah, they kind of are there, and yeah, the center spot's important because, you know, that's the guy communicating with the quarterback the most and, you know, pointing out different protections and kind of helping the quarterback identify who the Mike linebacker is, and by that's the point of them setting their protection scheme on any given play. But when they identify the Mike, it means, okay, this guy has that guy, and then from there on, every single person on that offensive line knows who they're assigned to on every play. And that all happens in the moment at the line of scrimmage. So when you have an inexperienced center in there, it can cause some problems that aren't necessarily obvious, you know, while you're watching a game. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what was going on with Hronos Grasso last year and what led to some of those struggles that weren't necessarily so obvious when you were just watching the games. And so I think that goes into this decision the Bears are making today and making Ted Larson the veteran, who not necessarily, he hasn't really been a center all that much in his career, but he has done it before, but he's a vet. He's seen a lot of pro games before, a lot more than Cody Whitehair has as a rookie. And so I get their mindset there.
All right, one last question just about your piece that's on WGN Radio now, catching up with the second draft class of Ryan Pace. From the rookie class that's at camp, who's shining the brightest?
Ooh, who is shining the brightest? No, it's a good question. I mean, if the definition of your question is kind of like who's the most obvious that's making the big plays, it's probably still Daniel Braverman, the seventh-round wide receiver, who has just caught everything, and he's made some spectacular grabs. The guy who I think is the most pro-ready and ready to go week one, though, is Cody Whitehair, who I've been talking about. Right. And actually, you know, I identified him as a guy going back to January at the Senior Bowl in Mobile, Alabama, as somebody who might not have the highest upside, so he might not be a first-round pick, but somebody who I really thought was just so steady and could play week one if he needed to, and he's going to need to for the Chicago Bears. So that's a good sign. You know, I've said multiple times, and I mean this as a compliment, not an insult, and it was in my piece today, he's boring. He's boring when you watch him. That's a good thing for an offensive lineman. He just I watched his tape out of Kansas State. I was bored because it was just every single rep was the same. It was just him doing his job. Nothing spectacular, nothing out of the ordinary. Just he blocked the guy every single time. It was so steady. And I think that's what the Bears have seen from him so far in camp, and that's a good thing.
Adam Hoge, covering the Bears and Bourbonnais. Big game coming up here on Thursday, but we'll check back with you tomorrow. Adam, you can check out his stuff at WGNradio.com/Bears. Adam, thanks for joining us, bud.
Thanks, Justin.
Oh, that song. We know it so well. Another man who knows it so well is a man who played with it at his back, I guess is what you would say. Doug Plank. Doug Plank is the monster safety for the Chicago Bears, number 46, of course, the inspiration for the 46D. And now a regular here on The Download has announced today that Doug Plank will be joining us Monday nights on the program to give a little analysis and reaction to the Chicago Bears. And I cannot be happier with that news. Doug Plank joins us now. Doug, congratulations, I guess, is in order for me to have Doug Plank on the program.
No, listen, thank you. I just appreciate this opportunity. It's going to be fantastic this year to be able to come on each week with you and just talk about the Chicago Bears and really anything else that's happening in Chicago.
You know, it's exciting because we talked, and we talked a couple months back, you talked about how you do a lot of games for the NFL, for NFL radio. You're always around the country covering games that aren't necessarily Chicago. I mean, talk about that. I mean, you're going to have a pretty heavy schedule where if I wanted to, I could say, like, the Bears got blown out. I could say, let's talk about the game that Doug was on where Arizona played Tampa or something like that.
And you know what? Really, that's what makes it so hard, because you see some of these other teams and you know how they won and how they lost. You know, then you watch some of the Bear games, especially what was so painful last year was I did, I think, three home games in Soldier Field, and all of them were losses. And I think the one that I hurt most was the Arizona game. They opened the game with a 107-yard kickoff return. And, you know, the Bears just have to get better. You know, one thing that you learn in the National Football League, you play as hard as you can for those hometown fans. And I just felt bad for the Bear fans last year, because after 1-7, they didn't deserve that.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. It felt like they didn't do a good job of sort of defending the home turf. Is that something that the team works on when you have a terrible record like they did last year at home? Do they take it personal in the offseason and say, we're going to correct that?
You know, a lot of people don't realize that players, they're like human beings also, and it matters where they play, especially at home, because your family are there, your kids, you know, relatives, friends you have, you came in town. I mean, everything. You want to look great. You want the team to look good. And, you know, that's, I think, what was so disappointing about it last year. It's just, you know, some of those games they had a chance to win late in the games, and it just slipped through their fingers. But, you know, it's the Chicago Bears, and you got to believe next year is going to get better.
Doug, you cover the NFL from various places. What's the national reputation right now in the Chicago Bears? I mean, we talked to Adam Hogue about it, and he said they're not really tracking much at all. Is there any respect for the Bears around the country?
You know, right now, I think because of what happened, you know, the upheaval over the last two or three years. I mean, last year, despite the record not being as good as it could have been, you know, I think there was still like some improvement that was seen, you know, from the team in terms of offense and defense. You know, just having coached around the league, though, you know, with the Jets and the Falcons, you know, there's so much respect for the Chicago Bears. I mean, every team respects them for their defensive and their tough mentality. And, you know, they just need to get back to that. You know, having known a lot of players over the course of the years, and especially the coaches now, having coached, you know, I feel for them, because you can tell sometimes, you know, that they put a lot of hard work in and things just don't go their way. But, you know, I think it's time for the Chicago Bears, really. They've been down long enough. It's time for the fans, especially, to be able to go down to Soldier Field and watch a winning season.
It feels like management feels that, or sort of understands that sentiment. The offseason was dominated by bringing in defensive players, linebackers, speed for Vic Fangio. Do you think that a good defensive unit, a unit that gets on SportsCenter, a unit that, you know, has a couple pick sixes, takes it back to the house, that kind of thing, will change the national reputation back to the sort of monsters of the Midway?
You know what, Justin, I think it might, but, you know, the bottom line is they have to do it, and they have to show up. And, you know yourself, you go down there and you watch a game. Listen, you don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be a coach. You know when you can see effort. I mean, I love watching football games where guys are just flying around the field, trying to tackle each other, block, and all that sort of thing. And some of those efforts last year especially, I just didn't see that. I didn't see that desperation, especially at home. Like I said, you're playing in front of your family and your friends. Man, you don't hold anything back. You just let it go. So that's why, you know, I'm hoping that some of these injuries that are taking place now in training camp are more minor than they are major.
For you as a player, I mean, when you see that, when you see a team like the Bears and get an inordinate amount of injuries early on, I mean, you've been a part of training camps. You understand how it goes. I mean, is it a fluke that happens?
You know, think about this. You know, my first year, I led the team in tackles. I think I had 125 solo tackles. Just try falling on the ground 125 times, and not trying to get hurt. You know, then you got people landing on top of you. So I totally understand this. And that's why there's so many injuries early on in the beginning of training camp, because this is new to all those guys. I mean, you really learn how to practice. You learn how to fall. You're almost like a gymnast. You know, you're getting thrown in the air, you're coming down, you start learning how to tuck your shoulder and roll and do all these things. And you know what? It's not natural, because in the off season, you're not doing that. You're lifting weights and you're doing a whole bunch of other things. That's what's so disheartening about those first couple weeks. in all the injuries.
Oh, so good. Doug Plank joining me here. He's going to join us on Monday nights, every night here during the football season. Doug, one thing that's happening at Bears camp that the coaches and the quarterback kind of spoke out against is brawls. We're seeing a lot of skirmishes at Bears camp. Is that a usual thing? And I think that, you know, we saw the last one at Family Fest where it seemed like coaches and players said enough's enough.
I don't know. I mean, I never got in a lot of fights myself. My rookie year, I got in a fight. It was the only fight I ever got in the National Football League, and I got kicked out of the game like 1 minute later, and I found out that my fine was bigger than my whole paycheck for the game.
Yeah.
Guess what, guys? That was my last fight. After that, I don't care if a person hit me in the back of the leg, smacked me in the helmet. I was not going to fight. I was not going to swing. You know, the moment I could play football up until the whistle and sometimes even after – during some of those games, but you know, you just learn real early, don't fight. And you know, the bottom line is, I can see it a little bit in training camp. Nobody's been out there again, and you're trying to get into that take no prisoners mode. But you know, really, you know, a disciplined team knows when to fight and when not to fight.
All right, so coming up on Thursday night, the Denver Broncos and the Bears will square off in the first preseason game. What do you expect from the Bears? I mean, as a player, as an analyst, what are we supposed to be looking for as fans from a Bears team in their first preseason game?
Protection. I think the most important thing right now is to see what the offensive line can do. Can they protect a quarterback? And here's the other thing on defense. I don't care how many interceptions I got or forced fumbles or whatever. It was all because of the guys on the line of scrimmage. If you don't have performers on defense and offense that are blocking people or attacking the quarterback, you're not going to win. You can't win with little guys.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm looking at. I'm going to look at how well they can protect the quarterback, get him a chance to throw the ball to receivers downfield, and especially this defense. This defense has to get better. I mean, I didn't like watching it, you know, over the last couple of years, but definitely they're making some strides, obviously, through the draft and as far as an attitude is concerned. So I'm really looking for some significant improvement. And let's face it, I mean, you're playing the Broncos. No need to get excited to go play these guys.
Yeah, right? I mean, is there something to be said about a preseason game when you're playing the Super Bowl champs, or is it just sort of business as usual in the preseason?
I would say if you want to get a reputation made, go play against the Super Bowl champions. Start knocking some people around. Start knocking them, drill them into the ground. Guess what? You're going to start getting a reputation. There were other teams in the league when we played, like the Raiders. I didn't care if they lost every game or we lost every game. I'm trying to take down as many players as I can before that game ends. And I'm hitting guys walking off the field, coming on the field. It doesn't matter. You know, that's the kind of attitude I think the Chicago Bears need to have right now. Take no prisoners. Come out. Let everybody know, hey, this is the Chicago Bears.
That's right. That's what we like to hear from Doug Plank, who'll be joining us every Monday here on the Download on WGN Radio. We'll let you go, and we will talk to you next Monday when we break down what we saw in the preseason game on Thursday. Doug, can't thank you enough, and so excited to broadcast with you this season.
Thank you. Honestly, I'm looking forward to this. You are such a great guy to talk to and interview and just feedback information, and I really, really look forward to the season. And it's going to be fun.
All right, go Bears. It's a Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're keeping one eye on the Olympics tonight because we're kind of in a position. I just feel like I'm getting addicted to it after 2 or 3 days of watching swimming. Although I will be honest, I said this earlier, I feel like the graphics could be better. I need more, you know, like I need more, like the gold medal is on the head of the swimmer who's in first place, so I know who's winning. Like half the time they put the yellow line for the world record, and then they kind of just, you just kind of have to listen to the two broadcasters and just guess which guy hit the thing for. I don't know. I just feel like they could do a lot more. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Molly Green's going to join us. She's going to fan jam the Olympics tonight. She watched the entire prime time schedule tonight, so we didn't have to. And we could do a show, and we're going to talk to her about what we missed. What were the good moments? What were the bad moments? What were the funny moments? What were the broadcast moments? How many divers took showers? That's all they were doing for the first hour was diver showers. NBC5, Bob Costas with the diver showers. A new book goes inside one of the best literary stories of our area. That's right, the birthplace of writer Ernest Hemingway. The book is called Hidden Hemingway, and it really curates some of the great pieces in the Hemingway archives that are in Oak Park, Illinois. Robert K. Elder, Aaron Vetch, and Mark Chirino put the book together. And Rob Elder's in studio with me tonight. Rob, good to see you.
Hey, Justin. Thanks for having me.
How you doing? And congrats on the book.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank
this
you.
This is
you.
Really great. So it's Hidden Hemingway inside the Ernest Hemingway Archives of Oak Park. What moved you to write this book or put it together?
Well, I had been sort of the editor-in-chief of a chain of newspapers, the Pioneer Press, and it was not very well known, so we sort of sorted it out, but Ernest Hemingway had been rumored to write for one of those newspapers, the Oak Leaves in Oak Park. So I took a little bit of time and discovered, no, he did not write for the Oak Leaves, but he delivered it as a teen. And so that sort of led me down this rabbit hole, and we did a special section in the Oak Leaves, and then I talked to the executive director of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation in Oak Park, a guy named John Berry, and I said, why isn't there a book about this stuff? There's amazing stuff here. It's his entire life story told in objects. Why isn't there a book? Fast forward to 3 years later, and here we are.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there, obviously, a lot of tourism comes through Oak Park for Ernest Hemingway, but there's something that I think the area knows there's an Ernest Hemingway connection to somewhere, and Oak Park is the place. But you know, I was talking to Pete before the show that I feel like that's the extent of it. Like, for me, I'm like, oh, yeah, Ernest Hemingway. I think Oak Park. Okay.
Yeah.
That's about it. That's all I know.
I think some of that is because he's overshadowed by Frank Lloyd Wright. So there are a ton of Frank Lloyd Wright houses in Chicago, in Oak Park. The other part of it is, you know, there are a few famous figures from Oak Park. So it's Frank Lloyd Wright, Edgar Rice Burroughs, who did Tarzan, and John Carter of Mars, Hemingway, and then Kathy Griffith. So it's all
that must be what it
is. So, you know, for Frank Lloyd Wright, it's easy to go and see his houses and the tours there. I think Ernest Hemingway, he has his own museum. There are three houses actually that he lived in. And again, it's this sort of like rich history, his high school there. He was born and graduated high school with his twin, quote unquote, sister, Marceline. His whole adolescence is Oak Park based.
How for you as a writer? I mean, obviously you sort of how the book came together, but how much when you started? How much did you know, and how much did the book make you say, "Oh, I didn't know anything"?
Sure. Well, I go on the advice of a friend who says basically, you write the book to become the expert, not because you are the expert. And I'm, at this point, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but I know an awful lot. And, you know, I spent a couple of years, I read all of his stuff in order. So I have a pretty deep appreciation for the work, especially the short stories. I know a lot of biography.
Well, I mean, again, and I'm ashamed to say that I'm not much of an Ernest Hemingway guy, meaning I know Old Man and the Sea, but it's not something that I've spent a lot of time with. And because of reading this, I feel like I want to, because I want to know more. How particular or how vast was Oak Park as a character in Ernest Hemingway's work? Did he refer back to some of his stories as a teen and as a kid?
You know, not much. It's actually hidden. Really? I mean, this is the other reason I think there's some confusion about, like, Oak Park, Hemingway, I'm not really sure. It's because he sort of protected Oak Park, but also he had a very complicated relationship with Oak Park. You know, his parents were not initially very supportive of his work. In fact, when A Sun Also Rises came out in the 1920s, his mother called it the filthiest book released this year.
It's a nice thing to put on the back cover.
Yeah. And they were mortified that he had used sort of the surnames of some of his school friends in some of the work. You know, he never came back to Oak Park after his father's suicide in the late 20s. And in fact, I think it was in Esquire, he wrote that he went back to Oak Park and visited, and his home wasn't even there anymore. You know, it was a hot dog stand, which is blatantly untrue.
It gives you a little bit understanding that he may have had not bad feelings, but at least feelings.
Well, complicated feelings. I think about the family. I mean, there's a false quote that goes around all the time that allegedly Hemingway said that Oak Park was a place of wide lawns and narrow minds. But we debunk that. Like, you know, things he said and things he wrote probably more documented than any other writer. So it's just blatantly false. not to say he probably didn't, that sentiment probably wasn't there someplace, because he was breaking out of this, you know, conservative, uptight, you know, dry community.
So, I mean, it begs the question of Oak Park's, I mean, obviously Ernest Hemingway is one of the biggest writers of all time, but Oak Park has really created a cottage industry. There are archives, not just one, there are several in Oak Park. There are tours, I'm sure, that Ernest Hemingway
birthplace
turns,
home,
birthplace home, that kind of stuff. Is that complicated in the way that Ernest Hemingway may not have looked back on his time at Oak Park? Did they mention that part when they're talking about the
I mean, I think they're pretty upfront about that. You know, his sort of literary alter ego is a character named Nick Adams. But even Nick Adams is more about Michigan, because he spent all of his summers in Michigan. So, no, they're pretty upfront with his complicated relationship with his family. You know, very famously among Hemingway scholars, you know, he had this love-hate relationship with his mother. And he, at one point, I think it was McCall's magazine, wanted to come and do a profile and said, oh, well, we'll go to your hometown, we'll interview your mother. And he said, don't you dare. If you even attempt that, I will not only stop cooperating with this profile, but I will cut this woman off. You will leave her financially destitute. He also warned his mother, do not talk to anybody. So it was...
can you glean that to be protectionism, like he's trying to protect, or is it more that he doesn't want the stories or the connection between his family?
I think it's
family,
both. You know? I think it's both. I think he worked so hard to build this legend, this hyper-masculine papa. He didn't want people to know that, you know, until age two or three, you know, he was often dressed as a little girl. So he could pass literally as the twin sister of his older sister, Marceline. I mean, it was such a, you know, an unusual family myth that Grace Hall Hemingway, his mother, held the sister back. She gave her an extra year of kindergarten so they could enter grade school together and graduate as twins.
Rob, I mean, we'll continue this conversation. We're going to get to hit the news here with Bob Kessler in just a moment. But, I mean, it is fascinating to know. I mean, and the book has got such great, and we'll get into this after the news.
Well, I was going to say, there's pictures of that, too, of him dressed as a little girl, a couple pictures of it. And in fact, on the back of one of them, Marceline, his sister, who wrote a book about the family called At the Hemingways, she wrote on the back saying, this picture did not make it into my book.
Yikes. Well, I'm always, I mean, there's Hemingway's Oak Park. There's the guide, right? That's in your book about the different places. And I want to talk about those places, the birthplace and museum. There's a Hemingway museum. There's the elementary school that he went to. There's the cemetery. There's there's so many different things that have something to do with Hemingway's life. Mm-hmm. So it does feel like Oak Park has fully embraced Ernest Hemingway as theirs.
There's a Hemingway district. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing. But it is hard, because Frank Lloyd Wright's footprint literally is all over that town. What I tried to find, though, was, you know, they were not contemporaries. Frank Lloyd Wright would have been older and would have left actually with his mistress by the time Hemingway was a teen. But I couldn't find out if the men had ever met or if they had an opinion of one another.
Right, because they both would have shared the space. Right?
Yeah, and I think actually it's possible Hemingway delivered to his family home, the Oak Leaves. And I think in one of the drafts, Marceline Hemingway talks about attending a party at the Wright's house.
Because the Wrights would have been a big deal while he was delivering newspapers.
Well, he would have been a big deal, but also a source of shame. Like, he left Oak Park for the wife of a client. You know, it was a huge, huge scandal.
So maybe, Well, I also think that the you know, the through line, which we'll explore coming out here, the idea that this town has put so much, and it's a beautiful, beautiful town, and the history, to be able to embrace Ernest Hemingway and his life and have the reality that Ernest Hemingway was not either, and it, you can be disputed whether he's a fan of the town or didn't want that to be part of his history, is really interesting.
Yeah, well, he always protected it. He really did. In fact, he said, you know, in trap shooting vernacular, he said, I always gave it a miss. So he never shot at Oak Park. So I think he was the same way with Michigan as well. Petoskey, all those northern towns. But a very complicated relationship. You know, he even joked that maybe his next book would be burned on the steps of the Oak Park Library. So very locally conscious.
All right, let's continue the conversation after the news here. The book is Hidden Hemingway, Inside the Ernest Hemingway Archives of Oak Park. Robert K. Elder's one of the authors. He's in studio with me. We'll be right back. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Olympics in the 10 o'clock hour tonight. No Studio 435. The band Varsity canceled on us tonight, which is a bummer. One of the singers is sick, so we're going to have no live music tonight, which, you know what, we'll give Bob Ferguson a break, although he's setting up for some stuff for Patty Vasquez. But at 10 o'clock, we'll fan jam the Olympics. If you guys want to, if you want to participate, let me know. 312-981-7200. If you saw something fun or exciting, or you thought that there was a part of the Olympics tonight that you want to talk about, let's do it in the 10 o'clock hour. We'll do that instead of the music. Sound good? 312-981-7200. Right now in studio with me, we continue the conversation about Hidden Hemingway, Inside the Ernest Hemingway Archives of Oak Park. Robert Elder is one of the co-authors of the book. He's in studio with me. You know, we talked about what, you know, there's not just one archive.
Right.
There's a couple archives in Oak Park. Working on this book and putting it together, which a lot of great sort of letters and pictures and all the stuff that's in here. What's in here? What did you grab from the Oak Park archives to put into this book?
Sure. So what we wanted to do was have sort of a big, beautiful coffee table book, you know, a sort of a way to explain his life story through archives. So in order to do that, we had to go to a couple different places. So the big one, of course, is the Ernest Hemingway Foundation Archives of Oak Park. I'm saying that wrong. Ernest Hemingway Foundation of Oak Park Archives, which is on the third floor of the Oak Park Public Library.
Okay.
So that is a ton of stuff, including the papers of Marceline Hemingway, his sister. So there was also a collector named Waring Jones who collected a ton of stuff, like his book plates and wine cards and, you know, receipts. And Hemingway was a pack rat, so he left a lot of stuff behind. You know, some of the stuff...
That's good.
Yeah, you know, it's great for us, scholars, right? Yeah. The other thing, at the Historical Society of Oak Park in River Forest, Frank Lippo helped us out there. We actually found letters that Hemingway scholars didn't know existed. So we were able to, just in the process of this book, get those into the third volume of his collected letters.
Well, let me ask. I mean, there has to be there are a lot of Hemingway scholars. Have been a lot of Hemingway stories and Hemingway history projects, books and otherwise. Yeah. So how do you go about telling his story in a way that hasn't been told before?
Well, sometimes it's just for a new audience. And I think for this sort of social media savvy and photo savvy audience, it's a way to rediscover him. So maybe you didn't get him in high school, mm-hmm. and you're wondering again what the big deal is. People right. forget that, you know, his sort of minimalist writing was this avant-garde thing. You know, it wasn't lazy. It was a very tight thing. And then people would infer things into the story. They would bring themselves to the story. So that's one of the ways we did that. You asked about the other archives. So there's some material at the high school, which we did not get access to, unfortunately. And then the library itself has a whole bunch of, high school assignments and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They're things that are really, really interesting.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, one of the things that we found that we thought initially was a poetry assignment turns out to be a love letter. It's written, and I wrote about this for the Chicago Tribune. It turned out to be a woman named Annette DeVoe, and I tracked down her family, and it was really, really interesting because even though he's been written about, you know, so much, there are always new things to find. In this case, we get to debunk, for example, the fact that, you know, at least, you know, three or four of his high school contemporaries said, like, no, Ernest was not interested in girls at all. He was more interested in hunting and fishing.
Right,
and,
right. No high school girlfriend, that kind of
right.
thing.
Right, and so right. we found that not to be true and found this very, very passionate love note, you know, like your matchless grace, your, you know, your beauty, and this line, I'd gladly walk through hell with you or give my life. So it's, you know, that very weighty thing that happens when you fall in love in your teens.
Wow. And so that's stuff that the scholars have not seen. They just skipped over it because they didn't look in the right spot, or they thought it was a homework assignment or whatever.
Right. It was. I think it had been. Somebody reached out later and noted that it had been published in a scholarly journal, but no one ever looked up the family. And the family has been great. They're in Cleveland and L.A. and all over. And you know, there's a little bit of controversy about what the nature of their relationship was, because it runs counter to the, you know, narrative of their parents or their grandparents and how they met. Yeah, it was the first time we were able to sort of give a voice and a face to Annette.
It's really interesting. Hidden Hemingway inside the Ernest Hemingway archives of Oak Park. What else do you have in the book? I mean, there's letters, there's photos. I mean, talk about some of the things that are that make this book possible. There's a lot of letters. I'm surprised that mean, he's done a lot of writing back and forth.
Right, right. Well, and I think it's Cambridge University Press. I think they're on the third volume of his collected letters, and I think it's projected at like 17 volumes, and these are thick books. So, you know, he wrote more letters than he wrote anything. So we found some undiscovered letters at the Historical Society. Oak Park also is home of the Agnes von Karowski letters. So the World War One nurse, his nurse that he fell in love with, who was the model for Catherine Barclay in A Farewell to Arms. So that's there. We also found a note that suggests that he had an affair with his sister-in-law.
Oh, no. Yeah. What was the... tell me about that.
Well, he was married four times, and we're talking about his second wife, Pauline Pfeiffer, with whom he had two children. And again, it's just this little note, and it's written on the back of a calling card. And it seems sort of innocuous. It says, you know, on the envelope, it says, Ernest Hemingway, please do not open until on board. And then you open it up and it says, just a little something to brighten the way, with love, Ginny. And I, you know, coming into this cold, I just thought Ginny was one of his paramours, you know, just somebody that he had a romantic connection with or something. Mm-hmm. But the more I looked into it, it's a little too familiar. You know, the more we looked into it, we found that when he first met Pauline and Ginny, he met them together, and he was more attracted to Ginny, but he liked Pauline's fashion sense. So there's this quote where he said, I'd like to take her out, but in her sister's coat. And they had this really strong bond. He drank out of a flask he called his Ginny, J-I-N-N-Y. And he originally... dedicated Men Without Women, one of his short story collections, to her. And it was changed before publication. So there's a lot of untold stuff there. She had relationships with men and women. So that was certainly intriguing for him. But again, more to explore and more to find, just, you know, where you, as you keep digging. I always say that archives are this sort of special place where stories are waiting to be found.
For you, as a journalist and a longtime journalist here in town, I mean, a project like this, where you dig deep into an archive of a celebrity, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it the same kind of joy as working on an investigative piece, as a long form article for a magazine, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the sense of discovery is still there. You still get that juice. And I plug a friend's conference, I think it's in September. I'm actually talking about this, the Chicago Writers Conference. There's a website, check it out. But but I'm talking about this very thing because, you know, Eric Larson's Devil in the White City.
Yeah.
That story was around forever. You know, any newspaper, any magazine here could have done that, but he turned it into this riveting book, you know, about America's first serial killer and the World's Fair. So I think these stories are around us all the time, and all we have to do is just scratch beneath the surface just a little bit. I don't think people do that often enough.
It's fascinating because, like you said, I mean, we all kind of know it. We know the story that Ernest Hemingway, you know, was born and grew up in Oak Park, Illinois. Mm. And that story has been told. But as you dig into the archives, you're right. There's so many things in here that are kernels that you didn't know about that tell a whole different story than the one that I had in my mind.
Well, it helps you understand him better. You know, like the fact that he was raised as this twin and was dressed as a girl. Perhaps it was a charming Victorian custom, or maybe it was something creepy that his mother pushed. It helps you understand at least his hyper-masculinity. It puts it in a different light. So yeah, I mean, there are always things you can discover.
You know, for you as on the other side, I mean, you have to, you know, sort of live, you know, eat, breathe, sleep, Ernest Hemingway. And you've been working on this for a while. This came out a couple weeks ago. Is there a point where you're just like, all right, I'm done with Ernest Hemingway?
Yeah, that was a couple weeks ago. but you know, the thing that is really interesting about this is as I go forward, more people come out and want to talk about him. And I discover new things all the time. And even the work, it helps me appreciate the work because I was sort of like you. I did not have a deep appreciation for the work. And now I have a fondness for Death in the Afternoon because it's him talking as an author, even though I think the bullfighting is abhorrent. It's not to my taste. For Whom the Bell Tolls is this amazing, weird little book that's written seemingly in Spanish but translated into English because it has the thee and the thou, and it's just weird, wonderful mashup. And then the short stories.
Yeah.
You know, there is a short story that I'm still sort of haunted by called The Sea Change. And it's a very, very short story, but it's about a man and a woman who are at a bar. And it's very, very clear that she is leading him to have an affair with another woman. This was written in the 1920s. You know, and the way he writes about it and the way it's coded is so interesting. And it seems so modern. So it helps me see him in a different light and have exchanges like this.
All right. So the interesting thing, I mean, is people are texting in. You know, someone said, I think I used to live across the street from a Hemingway residence, 1226 North Dearborn. I mean, there Hemingway has a tremendous history, not only in Oak Park, but in Chicago. And that's a history that I don't know is necessarily mine for everything that's worth. There's still more, I guess, my point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if your folks are interested, I actually listed this. We have a Twitter account, at Hidden Hemingway, and it's on Facebook as well. Actually, the website is hiddenhemingway.com. I actually list all the places he lived in Chicago. So he lived, I think, at the Dearborn address with his wife Hadley when he was a correspondent for the Toronto Star. So, you know, he lived a bunch of places. Actually, I found out that when I was here as a Cub reporter, 15 years ago, I lived next door to a place where he had lived. Actually, the Zebra Lounge, you know, was it 1220 North State Street? He had lived right there. That was his block for a while. There's so much to be discovered. And again, to understand him in context.
Well, it's a great read, and you should check it out. Hidden Hemingway, Inside the Ernest Hemingway Archives of Oak Park. The authors are Robert Elder, Aaron Vetch, and Mark Chirino. Robert K. Elder in studio tonight. Rob, thanks so much. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And good luck with the rest of the tour. You still got some tour dates on this, right?
We're busy for a whole year.
Yeah. Have fun with that.
Thank you.
Such an interesting story about Ernest Hemingway, and a story that, I mean, I feel like you could tell by people who text in know a lot about, and people really get very interested in the history of Ernest Hemingway. I know my dad does. But I think it is the idea of being able to not only track, but sort of chronicle somebody's childhood and really get deep, and that's what Rob and his co-authors are doing. It really gives you a better idea of the sort of who he was, this identity that we know, this super machismo, this guy who kills Nazis and, you know, kills bears with his bare hands, and he writes he's the most interesting man in the world, that kind of thing. And you find out that he was dressed up like a girl when he was really young. Now, that could be just a some weird kind of, you know, Victorian thing that people did, you know, at the turn of the century that you're like, oh, that's what everybody did if you looked at it. Or it could be something much more creepy. I think the other storyline out of that, which we didn't even get into, is that, you know, there's a lot in Ernest Hemingway's life, and Rob and I were just talking on the way out, that seems far-fetched, you know, as a writer. You know, we were talking about him as a war correspondent, and, you know, he was a war correspondent. He claims to have killed 120 some odd Nazis, which you're a war correspondent. What are you killing people for? And secondly, that number is pretty high for what turned out to be a 4-month deal. He was in World War II in Germany for 4 months. He killed 122 people in 4 months. But it makes me think about what Jesse Ball was talking about, the lie. You know, that at a different point it became the negative connotation of a lie. He may have embellished that for the story he was telling, and it was an acceptable lie, and it's not the same as the lie. If you did that today as a writer, or if somebody, you know, the bravado came up on, you know, gosh, you hear it with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Oh, such liars. It's the way that, like, our own perception of our society and the stories we tell have changed. And, you know, I'm not going to call Ernest Hemingway a liar. I don't know anything about it, but it sounds at least difficult to comprehend. So anyway, there you go. All right, the Olympics coming up here. I'm excited. Michael Phelps run yet or swim? He's not doing a track and field. When is track and field? I hate that that's after the fact. They consider that to be like prime time.
Next week.
That's Carl Lewis that. Prime time. Is Carl Lewis running this year? He's not running?
I don't think so.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I don't know any of the... It's like one of those things, you watch it for a day and then you realize who everybody is. You just remember from
last time. Usain Bolt. He'll probably be back. We know the guy with the fake legs is in jail, right?
Oh, yeah.
He raced last... he was a big hero, Olympic hero, until he killed his wife, right? Or girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
I could say that because he was convicted of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know much. We're going to talk with Molly Green. She's fan jamming the Olympics. She's watching it. Well, Molly's watching this whole thing, and there's some good stuff. I've turned my head. We have a little TV right to the side here, and I have it on mute. Usually it'll be a baseball game or CNN, row like CNN on this thing, and I have the Olympics up, and every time I look over, it is a swimmer's butt, or a swimmer who's backstage. Who's like, and you can, I don't know what the announcers are saying, probably saying something like, such intensity. Look at them backstage. They got a bald cap on and maybe their headphones, and they're doing a little dance, getting ready, because they're going to swim like in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot on Twitter. There's some sort of Michael Phelps face that he had made that he's sitting down with his cap and his headphones on, but he's making a really weird scrunched up face as somebody's walking past him. I don't know if that's like his main competitor or whatever, but I'm seeing everybody's posting this picture of Michael Phelps.
Well, I have to ask Molly because I missed a little bit of it, and I will ask her, but there were the two, there was the American swimmer woman and the Russian swimmer.
Right.
And they had a little shade. She like did a little not like a little Dikembe Mutombo.
Finger wave.
And then I think the race was tonight. So I'm sure someone could text in and tell us who won, but we'll let Molly do that. You know,
because she was the Russian is
she's a doper.
A doper, yeah.
And I love it. The U.S. swimmer's like, not today. Get that doping out of here.
Hope she won.
Yeah, right. I hope that the Russian won, just so it's like, yeah, well, they doped up. That's what happens. You win. So we'll get that coming up here at 10 o'clock. I'm realizing I'm going to have to eat a granola bar.
All right.
Coming up here because my experiment of taking the frozen food that I froze from my crock pot, the Download Nation remembers this over the winter. I really got into crock potting. That was a thing. I get so many recipes sent to me. Thank you so much. All sorts of stuff. And I felt like I was letting it go to waste by freezing it. And this week, my experiment is taking that stuff out. The one thing I have not learned, and I will learn, is that I don't put what it is on the outside. So I just put it in my freezer. And now today, I'm looking at it. I'm like, one is red. One is a little bit purple. One's like brown. So it's I don't know what they are.
Crockpot roulette.
I'm playing crockpot roulette.
Just grabbing one.
So today I did it, and it was corned beef and cabbage. So that was specifically, I know that's from spring. That's from St. Patrick's Day. And not the best choice for an August evening.
No.
But then there's just so much like mush. It turns to mush, like all the potatoes and all the stuff around it. It's mush.
Can I offer you some advice?
Yeah, do it.
Fresh Saver.
What is that?
You know that vacuum sealer?
Oh, yeah.
You got to get yourself one of those because then you don't get freezer burn.
I don't feel like there was much freezer burn, although there probably could have been. I don't know.
And it's all fresh.
The problem I had is it's just turned to mush. Like when I ate it, the only stuff that was really good was the corned beef, and then everything else was just mush, watery mush.
Is there a way that you can defrost it and then just cook it regularly?
I don't know. What now? Okay, now, now.
Because now, like, I feel like when you microwave it,
there's no other way, Esmeralda. There's no way I'm gonna right. I'm just gonna microwave that thing till it's hot.
You could parboil the potatoes.
Okay.
So they'd be just a little bit raw. So then when you do microwave them, they'll cook the whole way through.
All right. Now you know what? This got to the MFA in crock potting. I'm not there yet. It's gonna have to be next summer. I'm just not there yet. No, mixed beats. I thought maybe there'd be like a remix. Put some dubstep in it. Some trip hop. You know, change it up. There it is. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with Pete Zimmerman, Esmeralda Leon, Bob Kessler, and tonight we thought we would bring back one of our favorite segments from last year. When the Cubs were going down the stretch, we decided to introduce a segment we called the Fan Jam, where we let fans of the Cubs, not commentators and sort of, you know, pundits, tell us about what happened in last night's game or tonight's game, but fans. It's a little different, and we thought, why not do the same thing with Olympics? There's so much going on that we don't get a chance to see. But we wish we were at home to watch, especially when it comes to beach volleyball. A lot going on right now. There's just a bunch of sand flying up in the air, and there you go. So joining us on the line, Molly Green, one of the original fan jammers for the Cubs. She's watching the Olympics, so we don't have to tonight. Molly, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Was it a worthwhile experiment assignment for you to do this tonight?
It was. I'm a big Olympics fan. When I hear that John Williams theme, I get really, like, my heart beats faster and I get really excited about it. So I love the Olympics.
Not the John Tesh version, but you like the John Williams version better.
I don't know if the John Tesh is as, like, powerful as that. So I think it's, you need the original.
All right. Well, 312-981-7200. You could text in or call in and we could talk about the Olympics tonight. No Studio 435. The band Varsity canceled tonight. They had a sick singer, so we're going to talk Olympics instead, which I think is appropriate because there's a lot going on. So, all right. So, what's the overall theme of today's Olympics? What was the feel of the coverage tonight, Monday, August 8th?
It started out with diving, and so we're seeing a lot of like the same people we've seen for many Olympics now. And so that with diving, it's David Bodaya, and who's an American, and Tom Daley, who's British, who kind of looks like he has like a One Direction look.
Which
to
one,
him.
The British guy?
Yeah, yeah. So David Bodaya won silver, Tom Daley won bronze, and David Bodaya's partner's name is Steele Johnson, which I enjoyed. That was my favorite name of the night. But that was pretty, it wasn't too, it, I don't know, that was pretty uneventful. Yeah. And
is it as exciting as it was when Greg Louganis was diving? I mean, same
no,
kind of,
they no. made, they make lots of comments about like, about like remembering how great Greg Louganis was. So if that tells you anything about how it is.
That was definitely, that's not how Louganis would have done it.
And the commentators like to, they want to make sure that you know that they know better than you about it. So they have to, like, before the dive is even done, they have to, like, you know, say if it was terrible or great. There's, like, nothing in between.
Yeah. I always find that to be one of the toughest things as a fan to, I always, diving specifically, when they dive and they hit the water, I'm always like, good, bad, someone tell me. I have no idea. It all looks the same
yeah.
to me.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
All right, so good.
I mean, it's incredible. I can't, it's one of those things where I can't ever imagine how they do that, but
right.
Yeah. So I like the swimming because I'm competitive. I like a really competitive race when it's really close and when there's like rivals involved in it. And NBC likes rivals as well. So they're really pushing that angle on it. Michael Phelps swam tonight, but it was just a semifinal, but that was like, that's probably like the highlight of the night and probably the thing that people are talking about most is when he was in like the warm-up room. Mm-hmm. his rival, Chad Leclos, was shadow boxing in front of him. And so this is the guy who beat him last Olympics in this event. And so Michael Phelps has this just like full on throwing shade at Chad Leclos, like just such a like steely look at him. So that was like the biggest moment of the night. Was
so Chad Leclos,
game face.
Is that his name?
Chad Leclos.
Where's he from?
He's from
sounds Canadian.
No, I think he's from the Netherlands.
Okay. He sounds like he'd be like one of the bullies in one of the 80s sort of movies. Like
in Karate Kid. Or...
Yeah, exactly. Like Chad Leclos. Yeah.
South Africa?
Is it South African?
Yeah, it's South Africa.
They got a good swim team, the old RSA. You always see the RSA showing up in the semifinals and on the medal. A swimmer shadow boxing to get ready just right away, descriptively, just makes... I don't laugh.
And this evil look from Michael Phelps.
So hard.
So then Michael Phelps beat him in this. I mean, it's just a semifinal, but there was like a lot of anger in that and revenge in that swim. So tomorrow night is the final of that. So that will be exciting. So I'm looking forward to that.
Did Katie Ledecky swim tonight? I always like her.
She did. She was in the same event that Missy Franklin was trying to qualify for. And Missy Franklin did not qualify for that one.
To refresh my memory, who's Missy Franklin?
She was kind of the star last time.
Okay, got it.
And she has like since gone to college and sort of pulled away
a
bit. But she was like the really big star 4 years ago. So Katie Ledecky has taken over that. But the other big moment in swimming was another rivalry, and it was between Lily King, who's young, and the Russian, who she called a drug cheat. And
Missy King calls her that?
No, Lily King calls
Lily King.
Her like Russian rival a drug cheat, and has really come out saying that this is a swimmer who has tested positive for drugs in the past
twice.
The Russian,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And so that was like the big like Cold War style rivalry tonight.
Was there any shadow boxing?
No, there was finger wagging.
All right, right. I saw that yesterday. Anymore? I saw out of the corner of my eye they were both in the warm up area together.
Yeah,
and it seemed like a big psych out job.
There was booing, and there was just a lot. There was like Lily King seems pretty spunky, and she's definitely got the crowd on her.
Oh, really? They're booing at the swim meet, man. That's awesome. We're missing a great night, Beat. This could be our night. They're booing at the swim meet.
But it was a lot of swimming tonight, and a lot of we won many medals. We won in the Connor Dwyer, who's from Winnetka.
Yeah, did he win?
He won a bronze, but they showed a picture of him hugging Anthony Rizzo. So gold medal moment.
Was he there? Yeah. Was Rizzo there?
No, they did a little piece about him maybe Pete knows, but Connor Dwyer's he said that his grandfather hired Harry Carey.
Mm.
So I don't know who that is or hired and what.
There was this great moment I saw in the news, I think it was Saturday night, that Connor Dwyer finished fourth. He didn't make it into the whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the news went local live to like Cortland's Garage in Bucktown because the kid's from the area. And it was super, I was like, they would interview these guys who were like third cousin. He'd be like, yeah, sure, we're disappointed, but you know what? We think Connor's going to... I'm like, first of all, he's the fourth best swimmer in the world, and he lost by like a finger length. Like, maybe choose your words when you say you're disappointed. Like, calm down, everybody.
Yeah.
Drink another Coors Light and calm yourself.
Have some more sweet potato fries.
Yeah. I was totally, I don't know why I got so mad, but I was like, I was the first time, I'm not a Olympic aficionado. I haven't been paying attention to the Olympics to see the kids from Winnetka or Wilmette or wherever he's from. And then they come into fourth. I was like, that's amazing. And then I just felt there were so many, the word disappointment was thrown around. Like it was such a cliche by his third cousin, Tom, who came in from Colorado. I'm disappointed, but he's going to race again on Tuesday and Monday.
I hope none of the announcers gave his cousins credit for his win.
Yeah,
though
they go back to him. So, it's great. Now he's got bronze. We're hoping he gets silver, but you know,
All right, cool. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
And we'll come back. We'll do a little bit more fan jam because I want to get to what we're seeing now, the beach volleyball, and there's some other stuff too, and get through some of the more the fun moments of the Olympics here. We're fan jamming with Molly Green here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're fan jamming the Olympics. Molly Green watched tonight's primetime activities, so we didn't have to. 312-981-7200. If you have something to say about tonight's Olympics, feel free to chime in. Molly Green, okay, so we left the conversation talking about what the themes were. We're talking about swimming, which was good. Let's continue. Okay, here's my question.
Okay.
What was the best broadcast moment? Because, you know, we've already kind of gone with the best moments, the swimmers winning and the rivalries. But my favorite is watching the broadcast. They've been getting a little bit of trouble. I think the gymnastics guy is in trouble for sexist comments of not, or not even sexist comments.
They addressed
comments.
It tonight.
They did?
in a way. Well, it all kind of started with the opening ceremonies where they talked about how many women are on the U.S. team, but they only showed like the NBA players or Michael Phelps. And those kind of set the tone from there. And there's been, you know, a lot, I've read a lot today about, is this sexist? Is this not sexist? What's sexist? And I mean, it's gone beyond that to the gymnastics I got in trouble for. It was, that he, one of the gymnasts is adopted and he like said that those weren't really her parents.
Yeah. That's Simone Biles, like the biggest athlete of the games, right? I mean, she's like the world's greatest gymnast of all time. And this guy's going out of his way to nitpick on parents.
So there's been, that's sort of been an underlying theme. But tonight, we haven't seen much Bob Costas, but there was a Bob Costas segment that was just about what the women did today, and it just felt really forced into it.
like they're overcompensating?
Like they'd shown 3 hours of mostly men, and then here's what the women did today. Like, the women are great. Like we said, there's more women than men. The women are really great. Here's what they did today for, you know, 30 seconds. So make sure, check that off the list that got that worked in today. It felt very much like a reaction to...
Okay, so they're overcompensating and things
like that. Yeah, overcompensating.
I'm always... Okay, so help me out here because I only watched and I had family this week, so it was hard for me to actually listen to all of the color commentary. But it seems like there's always one guy who's kind of an announcer guy. And then there's another one who somehow played the sport in question. That's a great dive. That's how you're supposed to dive. That's how you're supposed to roll. Like that kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So is that similar across the board? If I watch rowing, is the rowing color commentary a former rower? Is that how it works? Or beach volleyball? Like, is the beach volleyball guy like, I used to play beach volleyball?
It is, yeah.
It's awesome.
Because I think it's been, I have it on mute right now. I'm watching it, but it's on mute. I think it's been like Kirch Karai has been doing it. And it's usually I can't think of a time when it hasn't been a former star or of that sport along with a professional.
No, I guess my question is, are they, I mean, I don't pay close enough attention to Olympic style sports throughout the year. But do they run this, like, does the guy who does the swimming color commentary, is he always the swimming color commentary for when they have swim meets and stuff like that?
No, I don't, as much of an Olympic fan as I am, I don't, like, I'll watch things up to the Olympics some, but not the rest of the other 4 years.
You're not watching the World Championships?
But it is the same people year to year.
Okay.
So they're like, yeah, like Rowdy Gaines is doing the swimming, and he's also a Cubs fan. They worked into it, too. Tim Daggett does the gymnastics.
Tim Daggett. So. What a great
it's
name.
The same people.
Let's go to, hey, everybody, I'm Justin Kaufman, my partner Tim Daggett.
Well, one of the strange things tonight was that they blew off the men's gymnastics. They were supposed to show the team final tonight, and the men, I don't want to spoil it, but they didn't win a medal. And...
it's already over?
It was some of the things at night are live and some are taped. So like right now, volleyball is live, swimming is live, but like the diving was taped from earlier in the day.
So the men's volleyball team, the indoor volleyball team, they're already out of it?
I don't I'm talking the gymnastics.
Oh, gymnastics. Sorry. I thought you said volleyball. Sorry.
Well, they still have the individuals, but the team final was tonight. And so women's is tomorrow.
So I don't understand why they wouldn't show that. That seems
I think I was looking on Twitter and a lot of people are wondering that because they didn't medal. But it's such a headlining sport for the Olympics.
They spent a lot of time on it. They spent a lot of time on it yesterday or Saturday when they were all qualifying and they couldn't figure out the pommel horse to save their butts. It was just like every one of them couldn't figure it out. I'm like, do you not know how to finish a routine? But and that's probably why they didn't show it, because they knew right off the bat that these guys are going to come in 12.
It wasn't that bad, but
So they didn't even show it, so there was no. But I guess they know it. I mean, if they know it's not going well, they don't want to show Americans. Maybe they're being
everyone out.
They're censoring to not show American futility.
How do you feel about beach volleyball?
I think that the American team, it's tremendous how dominating they are.
And it's dominating.
Yeah, and I think that the woman who's 38 years old, who's a tall one, Carrie Walsh, it's amazing to me because I watched in full on Saturday when they played, I think it was Australia, and she was, those kids, they were kids on the other side. They were 19. And this 5'5" dynamo just kept trying to challenge her because I think they think she's the weak point. She's 38 years old, and it's and she had something like 9 or 10 blocks, like for points. And I'm like, who does that? And I'm watching it right now, and it looks like they're once again dominating. And they, I don't know. There's something about sort of the domination of it. I think that's kind of weird the way what they're dressed in. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm very conflicted with.
Yeah, I'm conflicted too. I don't get it. I don't. And then someone told me, I saw on Twitter that when the men, they don't wear Speedos. They wear
they wear shorts.
Yeah, so why are the women wearing bikinis, essentially? I don't get it.
Dudes?
Is it really that
I don't know.
Callous?
I don't know.
Like, is it just the idea that no one will watch unless there's a ton of butts?
What's going on? They do have amazing butts. They look incredible. They have amazing bodies. They're in amazing shape. And, I mean, I guess that is what you wear on the beach. So, I have conflicting feelings about it.
Well, it just feels like it's,
and how much attention it's given.
I'm part of the problem because that's what I focused on at the beginning of the show. I'm like, I don't get it. I don't get why they're dressed like this, and it feels like it's forced because as we were just watching a Chinese team, she's just like, you could tell she's uncomfortable. She's digging around to try and fix it and put it right, and you're like, yeah, that, I don't know why it has to be so skin tight. Is there an advantage to it being skin tight in the sand? Maybe.
No, I feel cold. I'm like cold looking at them.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. But I do think the dominance is pretty intense. Like for her to be 38, I guess at the end of the day,
a 30-year-old doing well.
Yeah, and I guess at the end of the day, if you're into sport and watching people do things that you can't, when a 38-year-old gets out there and dominates in a way that she does in a sport where it's a lot of running around and jumping, and it does make you go, wow, that's pretty intense that someone of that age is beating 19-year-olds.
She has three children.
Yeah.
And
I saw this setup piece.
If you if you want to get inspired, you should follow her on Twitter because she has a lot of
Instagram.
Instagram, yeah. She has a lot of inspirational quotes. She's a fan of those.
Yeah, she's a big. You know what? That's what the announcer
really
said.
Right.
The announcer on Saturday is like, she. You know, if you go to her Instagram, she has a lot of inspirational quotes. Okay, well, that's great.
Oh, of course, I'm like a dummy. I'm like, oh, let me check that out. Oh yeah, this is an that's
there
inspiring.
Is no try, only do. Carrie Walsh Jennings. Yeah, I'm interested to see. I mean, I don't know if there's any challenge in this sport. If this if beach volleyball is just a natural like American sport, I don't know if that's the case. Like, are they really having huge? Like, is there a huge facility for the Chinese team where they're like, you know, like it's sort of Rocky IV with Russia, and they're doing the whole thing? You know, I don't know. I don't know because it seems like this would be a California type thing, right?
Right. Well, and where do they train? How many of them train in California, too? You know, like a lot of people train here, even when they're not from here. And I don't know about the Chinese team, but that comes up a lot where this person is from Hungary, but they train in Florida. Or,
right,
you know.
Right, right. The other thing is whenever they go to Kerry Walsh Jennings, and maybe you notice this, whenever they go to her still, where she's got her stats and she's holding the ball, like it's almost like a fashion shot, her outfit is even more revealing. It's lower cut. And you're like, what? I don't even know where to look. I don't know what's happening. And it's hard to believe that's the case, but I'm telling you, her hair is like done. It's like done in a way, and it's down. And then it's hard as someone who, to be honest, I'm trying to be as frank and not sort of guyish about it, but I would if she wore shorts, I would watch it.
Well, when I say dudes, I don't mean to like put you on the spot. I'm just saying like, is that NBC's reason that they think that that's who they're appealing?
Well, it must be IOC. I mean, right? It must be Olympic committees because they're the ones that do the uniforms and stuff. And I would say that NBC probably airs it because it must do well in ratings or they wouldn't put this sport anywhere near the prime time at 10 o'clock, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I just don't know. I think it's hard to play two-person beach volleyball. And they play it in a tremendously athletic way. I just think it's weird what they're dressed in.
What's with the stuff on their, cupping is the new thing where, everybody's cupping and has the big bruises or whatever they are.
Yeah, no, they do a different thing here.
They have like
the kinesio tape.
Yeah.
Well, she
had five shoulder surgeries.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Oh, yeah, because that's got to be the most unnatural thing, doing that tomahawk kind of thing where she's jumping in the air and hitting the ball. That's just got to be like that's worse than a pitcher throwing curveballs.
Yeah. Ugh. I spent a lot of the weekend trying to avoid the French gymnast. To see the French gymnast, he did 10 times worse than Joe Theismann.
Oh, like he broke
his leg, and that's all I kept on seeing. It's like, oh, what? Check out this picture of the French gymnast totally breaking his leg. I'm like, no, why do I want to see this?
I don't want to see that. All right, let's continue. If you got time, Molly, let's take a break. We'll hit the news. We'll come back and ask you a couple more questions from the Fan Jam. Fan jamming the primetime Olympics tonight here on the download. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Esmeralda, question quick. Do you have a problem with the way that the beach volleyball team dresses?
I mean, they can wear it. They can pull it off.
Yeah, okay.
Go for it.
How about you, Bob?
I think it's for a lot of reasons to get people to watch. Yeah, I think that's a reason.
It's not a competitive athletic advantage.
Of course not. Well, the guys aren't shirtless. If that were so, the guys would be wearing Speedos and no shirts.
I was going to say, I saw the Egyptian team. They're in leggings and long sleeve shirts. And exactly. One of them wears a hijab. So you don't need to be half naked to play volleyball.
But it's interesting, the women's swim team, the technical swimsuits that are kind of long, they go down like to their thigh.
Yeah, right.
That actually helps you swim faster, they say.
Well, there you go.
So
there it is. We got to the bottom of that.
I'm not saying I'm at the bottom of it, but I have questions.
No, but you nailed it. You've got questions, and you know what? That's a good part of the American viewing audience. I think we all have questions. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, we're fan jamming the Olympics with Molly Green, who's on the line. She watched the primetime Olympics tonight, so we didn't have to. We had a show to do, although in this case, I really wanted to watch. I got so excited, some of those swimming rivalries. Brett the Engineer, he was just in here, and he said that for the swimmers a couple years back, and they talked about it a little bit last night, that there was a controversy that the swimsuits were too aerodynamic in a way that they set a bunch of world records, and so the IOC outlawed and changed the...
You can't wear the full ones?
Yeah, I think it was... Yeah, I don't know what the... deal was.
Yeah, because it's pretty, like, all the guys tonight just had bottoms on, whereas there was a point where it was like a full, like, it looked like a diving suit that they would wear.
My favorite with the divers, and we were kind of joking as we were watching, but it was really fun to watch how they would follow those guys out of the pool, and then they would keep the camera on them while they showered.
Yeah.
And they would, like, shower, and it would be two showers right next to it. It was dual diving or something like that. So it was just, like, Well, and
I was
like,
thinking about as we're talking about the beach volleyball uniforms. They spend an awful lot of, a lot of showering and a lot of, like, just photos of them in, like, sexy poses. Yeah. And they're, like, very low riding.
I just like that they're talking about, well, that was a great dive. And there could be millions of shots you could do, but they follow these guys to the weird outdoor showers. And they watch the two diver kids shower.
Well, I always like when they have the little towels. It's like a washcloth that they use.
All right. So, what was the funniest moment tonight? I mean, there's always fun in the Olympics and funny moments. What would you say was the funny moment tonight?
I mean, I feel like it's the Michael Phelps face.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Was the funniest. They brought like Ryan Seacrest is there for some reason.
Of course, no, but all reasons. Like you're not cultural unless Ryan Seacrest is there.
Or is he for like is that for like the youth?
Exactly.
Ryan Seacrest is so like such a has this on the road. He's like he's been a thing for too long to be like cool, but why it's kind of he seems like the cool guy.
Right. They're like, we got to bring Dan Taggett. But if we're bringing Taggett, we have to bring Seacrest too.
So I feel like he was supposed to be kind of, like, funny.
He's kind of doing the outdoor Bob Costas thing, right? Like,
yeah,
he's
totally.
Kind of like, he.
Yeah.
They go to
he's
him and
he's out there building sandcastles and things like that.
Right,
so.
Yeah, great.
The funniest thing today was not on the primetime tonight. It was Johnny Weir and Tara Lipinski doing imitations of the swimming. Oh, now they're going to show gymnastics. They just popped it up. They have time because the...
they won so fast.
So they're going to sadly show the gymnastics. But there's a video out there of Johnny Weir and Tara Lipinski who made a name for themselves a couple, like, you know, it's like once they find one thing that works, they're going to like push it on us forever.
Right.
So now they're like our funny commentators for any Olympics. But it's them doing impressions of swimmers getting ready in their hotel room. So it's when a swimmer's like bending over and shaking their arms or like how they come out. It's really funny. So I would
all right, look that up.
The funniest thing from Olympics today.
What else should we know about today's events? I mean, we got the story on the men's gymnastic. Don't want to spoil it for everybody who's out there, but this is a taped delay that we're seeing now. But
so now we get to see them fall.
Yeah,
step out of bounds.
That's for late night audiences only.
And they've been cupping as well. They're covered as like cupping things.
Yeah, that's the American. And what I find interesting is like that's obviously a muscle relaxation technique. Why is the Americans the only one doing it?
Well, and the Russians are like accusing us of cheating by doing it.
Oh, really?
Too. And why is it suddenly, it's not a new thing. Like, why is it suddenly a new thing this year? And I guess it's not, they did a whole segment about it tonight. It's not traditional cupping. So maybe this technique is new. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like when baseball players all grow beards, like suddenly everyone has to do it. So.
Yeah. Cause I was reading that it doesn't, the science is not proven on it, so it's more like they all do it, and it may be even like a placebo effect. They feel, you know, just because,
really?
Yeah.
Like they're like, hey, I see your spots. I got spots too. Let's do this.
Yeah,
that's funny. What were some of the tidbits tonight about today's events, Molly?
About the things that happened earlier today that we didn't show tonight. The women's basketball won, women's volleyball. Yeah, again, there a lot of as much time as they could focusing on the women's sports. Floor hockey.
Floor hockey?
We
like
all
from gym class, like floor hockey? Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw handball, too. Handball was a thing. That's a weird sport. It's like basketball meets hockey without skates and a... You just throw the puck.
So we did well in that. And they didn't like, I mean, I guess, did the men play basketball? Was that earlier?
Yeah, they won today. They beat Venezuela, yeah.
Yeah, so there was just like a little bit of talk about that.
Okay. Well, that, okay, so it looks
ready
like...
Ready for tomorrow.
Yeah, all right. Well, Molly, I can't thank you enough for fan jamming tonight. We're watching. I just watched the U.S. gymnast fall down and pretty much give up.
Yeah, I think there was a lot...
Real strong.
...of that, and... it's like these, it's again, it's sort of like the same gymnast that we've seen for a few Olympics now on the men's side. And yeah. This seems to always
well, the women's are tomorrow and they're the
yeah,
superstars.
They're a gold medal favorite. Yeah, it's going to be really exciting. Okay.
All right. Molly Green, thanks so much for fan jamming the Olympics and you got to come back tomorrow night. Sound good?
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Justin. Good night.
So download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up tomorrow night on the program, Simon Helberg's going to be here, actor from Big Bang Theory. He's in Florence Foster Jenkins, the new movie with Meryl Streep. We're going to talk with him tomorrow night at the big table about his career, but more about this movie. I saw the movie. It comes out on Friday. This is the movie where Meryl Streep plays an opera singer from the 40s who she's a New York socialite who wants to be a singer. And so she has the money and the means to do so. And the problem is she's just not a good singer. And it's a really interesting sort of look at what art is and what music is and what's good singing, what's not. Because she's very popular. She becomes very popular because at first everyone's making fun of her. But then they're like, you know, we really like her spunk. We like her passion. We like what she brings to it. So that movie looks good. I mean, I saw it. It's good. But I'm looking forward to seeing it again. But Simon Helberg will be here tomorrow night. Also this week, David McKenzie is going to join us. He's the director of Hell or High Water, the new movie with Jeff Bridges and Chris Pine. So that's another good movie. That's being touted as one of the better sort of, it's like a modern day Western, some bank robber movie. So we'll talk with David McKenzie, who is the director of that film, a little bit later this week. So lots to do. And also this week, which is very exciting, is Kevin Matthews is going to join us. Kevin Matthews, the famed Chicago legend, radio midday host mornings. He was at AM 1000 for a long time, The Loop. We'll talk. He wrote a book, a memoir about his life and being diagnosed with MS in 2008. So we'll talk with Kevin Matthews. How cool is that? How cool is that? That's coming up on Thursday? Pete knows. Yeah, Thursday. Good show tonight. We didn't have Studio 435. I feel a tinge of jealousy because Bob is in studio setting up, which he does, and he's setting up for a band for Patty, so it's just sort of like, oh, man.
I know.
I love the feeling of having the drum kit right behind me and the everything spread out here. We'll get the band Varsity back in here sometime soon, but we'll pick back up next Monday.
Taylor Bennett.
Taylor Bennett's going to be in studio?
Next Monday night.
That's amazing. Taylor Bennett, a great hip-hop performer here in Chicago who is Chance the Rapper's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And he will be in studio performing live. I'll take that in a heartbeat, man. Let's make that a two-hour show. That guy's stuff is great. We had him on not too long ago and for his record. And I remember really digging that music. Like, it was one of those things where I put it on my phone and then I listened to it and I went back to it after the interview. So that's and we have a lot of musicians and a lot of entertainers that are on a show, and a lot of times you know when you're done with the interview you're like, well, I'll move on to the next thing. So to have Taylor on, that's great. I'm look forward to that. That's great. All right, what'd you do this weekend? This Olympics.
Yeah, we saw Dolly Parton yesterday.
Oh yeah,
I was one of the many people you've probably seen in your Facebook
feed. I can't believe
feed.
How many people went to see Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
Am I missing something? I must be missing something. She's great.
She's a national treasure. Delightful.
I just didn't know that so many people of our generation were into her because the pictures at Ravinia yesterday were, I mean, it was essentially every other picture.
Yeah. It was incredible. I was looking through Facebook and Instagram and stuff. I'm like, everybody, I didn't see anybody. Except I saw one little guy that I go to Orange Theory with, but I didn't say hi to him. But then I'm on Facebook and I see everybody, every single person that I follow on Facebook and Instagram are sitting at the Dolly Parton show. I'm like, I don't see any of you. I know
it's
huge.
Did you bring a ton of food?
Yeah, we brought a ton of food. Some fried chicken, got to But yeah, it was good. Yeah, she is just delightful. You know, she it was like half music and half storytelling. She'd be telling, you know, like about Jolene. Yeah, my husband, we met this girl down at the bank and for 45 minutes. Well, anyway, here's this song. Thought I'd tell you about it.
Island in the Stream.
She sang that, yeah.
She did?
I think the last song was Your 9 to 5.
That's so interesting to see what she would end with, what she opened with.
I don't remember what she opened with. It was a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
And then she did a medley of, like, cover songs. She did The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down by The Band and a couple of other Blowing in the Wind by Bob Dylan. But it could not have been more delightful.
I'm, again, amazed at how many people were head over heels in love with Dolly Parton last night.
And we kind of have it knocked up in Ravinia in that we know somebody that lives right next door, essentially.
No, that's perfect.
So you can just like you skip the part, like you skip the traffic getting in,
huge,
and then you bypass all that, and then you just pretty much park in the guy's driveway and then walk, you know, 35.
That's amazing.
50 feet
that's
to
like,
the.
That's a life hack.
Yeah, because like you see the see everybody. It's dark when it's over and people leave,
yeah, that's my
and it's
one
like
knock
gotta
on
wait.
Ravinia is just waiting for the train or waiting to
get
out of there.
It's like, tough.
It's, too much. It's a nice time. No doubt about it, but yeah. So
she's very exciting. She's coming out with a Christmas movie.
Oh yeah!
As you know, I'm a big Christmas aficionado fan, so I was very excited to see that she's going to have a Christmas movie coming out.
What is the Do you know what the title is?
Yeah, she met Christmas.
It's Christmas in Nashville.
Christmas Casual. I forget what it's called, but it's going to be great. Of course,
it's going to be great.
What about you? Do you see any?
No, I went out for family. I went to Indiana for family, and on the way out, my son, he's at that age. He just turned 9, and he got rid of the car seat, so now he's just straight up dude with a seatbelt.
Seat.
Yeah, isn't that great? And he decided because now he has, you'll love this, now he has this full-on freedom. He can choose either side. You know, he can move around. Like, he doesn't have to be in that one seat, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We just made this move, you know, just earlier this summer. So this is the first trip. So he decided to sit behind me as the driver, right? It took probably about 40 minutes for him to throw up. He threw up from car sickness. Like, he just got car sick.
Because he's not
I don't
secure,
know why. No, I don't know what his deal was. He's just being like, and then he threw up and didn't catch it in time. Had to be that guy who, I always wondered why people pulled over on the actual expressway.
Yeah.
You know, like, and around the, and it's
what,
dangerous.
What happened there, yeah.
But you're always like, geez, what, did the kid have to go to the bathroom or something? Nope, that was me. If you saw the old CRV, that was me on the toll road.
So you had to get out and clean it up?
I had to get out and clean it up. And
at least,
and then
as best
I we held the like the towel out so he could change, you know, out of his throw-up-y clothes into other clothes.
No.
You know, yeah, and it's like, he's like, I'm not taking off my clothes. I'm like, well, you know what? No one's looking, and you got to do it. So, I mean, it worked out fine. He wasn't sick or anything. He didn't, but it was a bummer of a moment for him.
Oh, man.
And it was funny, too, because I was of the mindset when this happened, I was of the mindset where I was like, well, all right. So he's just got to sit in, and we only got about 15 more miles, right?
You know? Can't do that.
Yeah, because I was like, I don't, you know, like, all right, he did it. You got to do it again? No? All right. And the wife was like, no, we got to pull over. And I'm like, oh, all right, well, okay.
Yeah, I probably would have just thought to just keep on going.
You're almost, in traffic, you know? Like, and I'm like, well, I don't feel that comfortable pulling off to the side, and I know the next exit is off of the expressway. I have another issue, too, with it. My iPass didn't work. So it was like 2 of 3 in the trifecta of things that could go wrong in a road trip. iPass not working, kid getting sick, tire blown out. Right? I didn't get the tire blown out.
So
I don't know what happened. Like, I guess it's on me, but the...
Oh, it's not like open road tolling,
no,
so it's
they
the,
stop
it's the gate,
yeah. And I, you know, right when I get there, they're like, I hand my... They go, can I see your transponder? And they're like, it don't work. It's invalid. And so I called while I was driving. It was terrible and dangerous, but I was like, you know, like essentially
that's
going,
why your
going over
son
the,
was throwing yeah, up.
Going over the Skyway Bridge, like reading the four digits of my driver's license to the guys on iPass. But I was like, and they're like, oh, my credit card changed. Like it changed, like I had like the date.
Yeah.
And they're like, when you didn't click the replenish button or whatever. I'm like, it was replenishing before. Now it's not doing it. So they're like, you should be fine. So I roll to the next toll. No. So I'm like that guy who's like, excuse me, can I go back up here? Or, like, you know, like, and then I get to the next one, and it's one of those where you take a ticket. But I didn't take a ticket because I was in the iPass thing, and I got through because the gate was open, but it said not accepted. I'm like, they'll figure it out later. But when I got to the ramp to get off, they're like, where's your ticket?
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I don't have one. It's a funny story. And she was not having it. I was like, well, I think I said this. You represent your state well. Like, I got
mad
because I was just like, because she's like, no ticket, full price. So, like, for what it should be 35 cents, ended up being $7.70. And I'm like, no. Right? You know, I'm like, no. Like, I just told you my situation. Even without the ticket, we're talking, you know where I just told you where I came on from. They're like, no ticket, $7.70. I'm like, that's why I'm like, you represent your state well. I hope you get to keep that money. I hope you get to keep that money.
So you gave it the $7?
It was like a credit card, yeah. I know. But I was very, I got very, like, this is a, like, my political statement to the state. And to, like, you know, like, you know, you really want to do the bidding for your master? Because you're not going to see any of my money. That money's going to the state. Like she cared. And I was like.
Don't they have that bit in Fargo?
It was the same thing?
He's getting out of the parking lot, the airport parking lot, and it was $4.
Yeah, right.
He's like, really? You think you're a big man? Here's your $4.
I should have done that. I came super close to, and then I was like, I had kind of a throw uppy kid in the back, and it was just like the whole moment. I was just like, you think you're better than me?
So how? Tell me how it is to back up out of a.
Luckily, what happened was they come over,
and they.
Yeah, where I was able to back up and move to a. I forgot how it worked, but yeah, it's. There really wasn't any way to back up because you can either back up into traffic coming on or there's a car already actually on you. So, like, the minute you put in reverse, there's already somebody on you and you're like, well, I'm just stuck here. But then someone meanders over.
Yeah, meander is a good word.
Yeah. You know, so you just it's like it's the nightmare situation with iPass. So I got it fixed, I think. When I got there, they go, oh, you didn't say you were traveling in Indiana because it was all, you know, iPass. They're like, it's immediate. It's fixed immediate in Illinois, but in Indiana, it's 48 hours. And I'm like, it's all one computer system, jerk. I left the jerk part off. But right, you know what I mean? Like, you're right. I mean, for the two computers. Yeah, yes, corresponding with the state of Indiana. Beep, boop, beep, boop. Like, come on. It's ridiculous. And when I came back the next day, it was fine. So I'm like, so your 48 hours was just a lie.
Bogus, yeah.
Just a lie. You're just like, oh, well, you picked the red. Oh, well, you picked the red one. Oh, okay. So. And that'll conclude our iPass stories for the evening.